This will be the only meeting between now and the end of the year. However, keep it open in your schedule that we may meet maybe a couple of times in February. So I'll get you more information on that when we know about it. Couple of announcements first. You notice we have a different committee legislative assistant today, and we're honored to have the top CLA of Ways and Means, Shirley Kotterick, with us. And as many of you heard, our regular CLA, Alicia Davis, is student teaching this fall. So she's on a leave of absence and will be back on January 16th and with us for next session. So, and Shirley's kind of famous in Ways and Means for her cookies, so she's baked some cookies, so please enjoy here today. Also, with today being Election Day, I know there was some concern about is it okay for our committee to meet on Election Day, and we did do some checking into that, and yes, it is fine, so don't worry about anything in regards to that today. It's all been checked out. And then also, with today's meeting, we're going to go through the morning here, and we'll break somewhere around 12:15, 12:30, depending on where we're at. I'd like to come back about 1:15 for the legislative reform discussion, because we would like to be done today between 2 and 2:30. And I hope that you will come back after lunch, because that discussion, I think, will be very enlightening. And so, Representative Kahn. Well, that is possible, but I think the legislative reform discussion, I don't want to cut that short. So I understand that a couple of you might have things going on right after lunch, so sorry about that. But anyway, let's go through the package here quickly. We're going to approve the minutes in a few minutes here. But the yellow sheet is the legislative reform ideas that we'll be looking at after lunch. There's a packet on rulemaking from Mr. Shepherd that he'll go through, the House research on military and veterans affairs, which we'll go over, and then Scott, Mr. Neske, if you could take a minute and just give us a real brief overview of the information here on the Camp Ripley information for tomorrow.
Sure, I put in the your folders there. Wolf and itinerary from the military affairs department about what we're going to be doing up at Ripley. And then also there are some driving directions for most of us are going to be flying up, some directions to get over to the airbase, how to get there tomorrow morning. And again, the plan is to be there about 10:30, take a little bit of time to check in, so because we'll be taking off around 11 is the plan. And just a couple other details about it. The military affairs, they said to for everyone to dress casual and a little bit warmer, as it might get a little chilly on the plane. And then it will be $4.50 per person for lunch. You can either pay me today or just bring that tomorrow morning when you come to the airbase, and you can pay that when we check in. And then I've collected most of them already, and one bit of information I didn't have before is that I need people's social security number. So if I haven't got that from you, I'll come and get that from you today yet before we leave. So, and if you have any other questions about it, just let me know.
Thank you. Okay, let's get the minutes approved here. Representative Wardlow.
I move we approve the minutes.
Representative Wardlow moves approval of the minutes of the May 10th meeting. Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes of the May 10th meeting are approved. Thank you. Okay, well, let's go ahead and get started then. Commissioner Dyrud here to start us out on the update of the Department of Veterans Affairs. Welcome. And welcome, Commissioner, and please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Clark Dyrud, Commissioner of Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Thank you for this opportunity to talk to you today. It's been a fairly hectic period of time for us. There's been a lot been going on. First of all, I'd like to thank you, Chair, and Representative Leffler, and Mullery is not here today, for authoring and co-authoring the outreach bill, which was very near and dear to our heart. I want to give you an update on the whole license plate issue. As you recall, the governor had the idea to create a Support Our Troops license plate, which would go to military affairs. to help needy families whose members were called to active duty. As the session progressed and came to an end, that changed to a formula whereby 50% of it would come to Veterans Affairs, 50% of it goes to Military Affairs. And the 50% that comes to our department would be split up, part of it going to the to make up the greater amount that the service organizations get from the legislature. A major part of it would go to our outreach, and the remainder would go to MACV, Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, the organization that deals with homeless veterans, getting them a place to stay and rehabilitated if at all possible. And then the remainder would be going to MACV. Vinland. So as the year ended, we were given a contingency to actually start operating the outreach, and the sale of the license plates is expected to begin around January 1st. And what has happened there, the final meeting for the license plate is actually November 10th, a couple of days from now. We've been going back and forth on the design has pretty much been finalized. The idea is there'll be 20,000 plates spread out around all the offices throughout the state. There'll be a big rollout at the governor's office right around Christmas time. The date to be dependent on when the plates are in place, obviously. There will be a lot of publicity at that time. And obviously, you will all be very much in the loop as we get more information. The idea is to keep the design somewhat secret until the great unveiling. So it's kind of... hopefully there'll be a lot of publicity and interest in the press, things of that nature. So as I say, that is very nearly the final design is just about in place. I think it will be quite wonderful. I think everyone will like that, and hopefully, as I've been going around talking to groups, I've been telling them to buy one for each of their cars. If they have two cars, if that's all they have, buy a third car so they can buy a third plate, and that seems to be going over well around the state. So there is a lot of interest being generated by that. So,
excuse me, Commissioner, I was hoping we'd see the design today, but you're going to keep it secret even from us, huh?
Well, I was told to keep it secret until the great unveiling. But
well, you piqued our interest.
Yes. Thank you. So the other thing with the demobilizations of many of the troops, we have been very actively involved. Representatives from our claims division have actually been going out and physically taking claims with, at the demobs, getting the returning service people right on location. And that seems to be working out well. There's been a lot of discussion about how to reach the returning service men and women. And I know personally when I got out of Vietnam and the service at one time, and the last thing I wanted to do is to hear anything about benefits or anything like that. So it's tricky. You have a lot of agencies that are working very hard trying to reach out to the returning service people, and many of them will have absolutely no interest in that. So that is kind of the tightrope that we are walking right now. There are many people meeting among agencies, and like we're starting to meet with Military Affairs and other agencies, and trying to coordinate and reach these people as best we can. Excuse and that'll me. Be an ongoing thing.
We have a question, Representative Stevenson.
Yes.
Thank you, Commissioner. One of the things that we've been working on kind of in the off season is some of the proposals for the next session in terms of veteran benefits. And Mr. Clary here and some of the others, Ron Lessman, who's in the audience here, and some of our other representatives that are representing the veterans have come up with some good points here. One of those is there's kind of a glitch in the university and the MNSCU system in terms of taking care of our returning veterans who are going back to higher education. And so some of that funding, we had talked about the last time a little bit on the funding, and I think had considered approaching the whole issue with support our troops, and it sounds like that provision has been there or is instituted. So we would definitely like to work with your department on making that happen. The groundwork is being laid even as we speak by a very aggressive and visionary young man on the U of M campus. And so if you can make that meeting on the 22nd, I think we'll be able to kind of connect, and that will be a real plus for our vets returning from Iraq.
Representative Severson, through chair. Yes, I really look forward to that. We have with our gentleman from our outreach program, has also contacted that person at the university through his own channels. And so this is a very interesting time because I say that there are so many people that want to help. And so what's going to be very important is coordinating and finding out who is out there. What are they doing, and to try to get together and all and get coordinated. So I'm looking very much forward to that meeting on the 22nd. And I think Military Affairs is becoming very much aware of the fact that they have a whole lot of people coming back over the next few years, and some of them will be Military Affairs people. In other words, they're still in the service or in the Guard or the Reserve, but that they will eventually become ours, in other words, Veterans Affairs, as they leave that. And so we're starting to meet with people from Military Affairs to try to, again, make seamless transitions between during that process as well. The other thing that we have started doing more of, and we welcome any requests from you, is we've been doing town hall meetings around the state. And what this is, we've actually been doing those at to a lesser degree for pretty much all of our life as an agency. What we do is we coordinate representatives from VA hospitals, VA regional offices, national cemetery, and the county service officers, and we go to a set area around. You know, around state. It might be a VFW club, it could be a Legion club, it could be a high school auditorium, whatever, and put on kind of an information fair for veterans. That's the wide range of veterans, not just returning, but I mean, this is the entire veterans community. And sometimes with advanced publicity, we've been getting as many as 120 people showing up for them. Sometimes it's with no publicity, it's very small. But this is an area that I think is of interest, and that you may be interested in having come to your area. It's sort of a turnkey operation. You get a chance to talk to the veterans in your district and sort of turn it over to us, and we will have all the people. Representative Liebling, I believe you were at one of them. I think those were that was one, unfortunately, where the press had forgotten to put it in the paper, so there wasn't the largest turnout. But I think you see the value of that type of an event to reach out to the veterans in your community. So that's something that you can be aware of. As far as I believe that's are there any questions about?
Yeah.
Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, you commented that what is your opinion on we'll keep you in the loop. I need an explanation.
Oh,
Commissioner.
Representative Dempsey, if you chair, you're referring to the license plate question.
Yes. Right.
Okay, as soon as we have the final design, and as soon as we have a date from DPS as to when they will be in place, then a date will be established for a the rollout. And at that point, you will get emails, letters, calls, if you want, with all the information about that. Because hopefully there will be a large event. And one thing that's being considered is maybe several rollouts, on a given day. You know, maybe one obviously here in the governor's office, and then maybe, you know, go to, I don't know, Rochester or Duluth or something like that. So all of that type of information will be available to you as soon as it's in place.
Madam Chair?
Follow-up, Representative Dempsey.
Yes, I would hope that, Commissioner, I would hope that you take the initiative and see to it that at least the members of this committee are informed as to what is taking place and so on in regard to that. You needn't respond to that, but I have a second question, and that is at the present time, what is the criteria for a veteran to, let's say, use the Veterans Hospital in Minneapolis? Now, some veterans are not eligible. Some are. My question to you in regard to that is what is the criteria, and why are there some veterans that can't use the facility? I don't get that. I need your help.
Commissioner.
Representative Dempsey, Chair. The question of who is eligible for a VA hospital has been one of the most gnarly questions over the years. I started as a county veteran service officer in 1973, started working for the state since 1980. And through that period of time, I don't know how many ebbs and flows in eligibility requirements I had seen. What this means, the long and the short for the veteran out in your districts, is they might, number one, think that they're eligible because they were several years ago, but now they're not. But even greater is that years ago they were told they didn't qualify at a given time, and now they do. The eligibility requirement has always been tied to money. In other words, from the federal budget. The federal dollars, obviously, but drives the VA system. And so the dollars, as they increase or decrease, they deal with they cut eligibility at various times. What has happened, and you will hear a lot of your constituents talk about this, they'll be talking about category levels. That's a phrase that you probably get a lot of questions on. Several years ago, the Congress passed a guideline opening the VA to everyone, all veterans, peacetime, wartime, service-connected, not service-connected. That was the good news. The bad news is that they didn't totally fund it always. So you had waiting lists that ballooned up to, in some cases, over 3 years to get be seen at a VA hospital if you hadn't been seen in the past. And they finally sort of got a handle on this, and the waiting lists now are probably down to about 2 or 3 months. But to this, at the same time, they created these category levels, 1 through 8. Category 1 would be a service-connected veteran at 100%, or a service-connected veteran being seen for a service-connected condition, or, you know, certain, they go through all these different categories. And what has happened is that now they have cut off the bottom, Category 8. And, by the way, throughout this process, they did create co-pays along the way, you know, for medicine and very similar to, the Medicare type of copay, and for the people that are not service connected. So what has happened now is Category 8s are being told that they are no longer going to be seen. If they are already in the system, they can continue to be seen. And I think what you will be seeing in the future, the table has been set. At any given year, they can say, okay, now we're going to cut off 7s and 8s. Now the funding is down, so it's going to be 6, 7, and 8. So I think I see the tables being set. If there is lack of funding for more of this in the future, where there will no longer be access for many of your constituents. And that is, thus you hear a great deal of questions and comments from service organizations. They have mandatory budgeting for the VA as high on their list. And so you'll hear a lot of your constituents talking about mandatory budgeting for the VA hospital system. And that is something that has not passed, and it does not appear that it will pass at the level of Congress. But that is being cried for by the service organizations to alleviate this problem of, you know, the eligibility always wavering. So I hope that answers your question.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We have another question. Representative Ruth Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, at a recent deployment ceremony in South Central Minnesota, a mother of a soldier caught me afterwards to say that she is concerned that her son, who joined the Guards in order to gain a tuition benefit, is having a difficult time using that benefit because, in her understanding, he must be active status in order to use the benefit, but he has been deployed, and he's concerned that there is a time clock on the benefit that, in such a way, with the repeat deployments, that he might not be able to take advantage of this benefit. I realize part of this is a very important federal issue. Are there things that we should be doing in Minnesota to help our Minnesota soldiers obtain the educational benefits that they deserve?
Before you answer that, Commissioner, I think some of that crosses over into military affairs, and maybe we can get a clarification here in a minute from Mr. Clary, but to Commissioner.
Representative Johnson, through the chair. I am aware of that, but as the chair points out, it is not within our agency at this time, but I'm well aware of that, and that is one of the issues that Representative Severson was referring to earlier. There is an ongoing committee that is looking at all the issues of education, reemployment, and trying to come to some understanding of what the problems are and ways to solve that. And in fact, I think I saw you at one of the meetings, I believe.
Proud to serve on that committee.
Right. So I think, I mean, that is exactly what needs to be looked into, because that is a problem, very definitely.
We'll work together.
All right, thank you.
And if we can get a clarification from Mr. Clary on that as well.
Okay, just to add a little detail, Madam Chair and Representative Johnson and Commissioner, Minnesota, well, both the state and federal education benefits for National Guard and Reserve can be used only while those soldiers are in the drill status period of the National Guard and Reserve contract, and usually that's the first 6 years of the 8-year contract. Now, some of these soldiers sign up in high school, even as juniors in high school, and have almost 2 years in by the time they graduate, and then go off to six months of training, and barely have 4 years left of their 6 years of drill status to use those federal and state national education benefits. However, when they get called to active duty, as you point out, they lose another 18 months or 2 years, and they could go to active duty twice. There are some that have almost no chance to use those benefits. Now, Minnesota, you all here extended the time frame in a very nice way by saying even if they end their 6 years and are no longer in drill status, maybe they even end their 8 years and are no longer in the National Guard, even as a ready reservist, they can still use those benefits for a good period of time, up to 2 years plus the amount of time they were in active duty. If they're disabled, up to 8 years. But the feds haven't done that yet with the Montgomery GI Bill, and there are over 30 or so bills in Congress dealing with the GI Bill, and I've looked at them, and not one of them addresses this issue. It just doesn't seem to have gotten to Congress yet. Minnesota could do, the legislature could lobby Congress in various ways. One way is individually, two is caucuses, three, get the governor on board, four might be to memorialize Congress, five might be through the newspapers. So there are some things that could be done, even though you don't have the direct power to do that.
And members, the packet that you have from House Research that we'll be going through shortly, page 5 at the top there gives a little description too related to this issue. Thank you. Any questions for members? Commissioner?
Madam Chair, one thing I should probably mention is you will be hearing, you probably already have heard, but there will be more and more press about the Minnesota Military Appreciation Fund. And this is, well, to cut to the chase, it's a form of a bonus to returning service people. This is money being raised by the private sector, and they are becoming, they are just kicking into high gear. They're their news about this. In fact, they're having a fundraiser with Senator McCain speaking here on the evening of Veterans Day. However, there will be the idea of this is that people coming back will get a bonus of some sort. A figure being bandied about is $1,000, but I'm not 100% sure of that. The secondary thing is if a person got a Purple Heart, in other words, was wounded, they would get a greater amount, and the families of veterans who would be killed in action would get something on the order of $10,000 or something. And like I said, this is totally being raised by the private sector. There's a gentleman named Sit of Sit Investments who is kind of spearheading this, but there are, I know Bill Cooper is involved, Sam Kaplan is involved, so there are business people from both sides of the political spectrum very much involved in this effort to raise funds for that. So that's completely private, but you will be hearing more and more about that.
Great, thank you. And we'll hear more tomorrow when we're at Camp Ripley, too. And Commissioner, before you leave, I just want to take the opportunity. Friday is Veterans Day, and so anybody in the audience or any members who are veterans, if you could just raise your hands and we could say thank you for your service. Thank you, Commissioner. Okay, next up, Department of Administration will give us an update. First up is Commissioner Dana Badgerow, along with Kathy Seibel, Drive to Excellence Project Manager. So welcome to the committee, and then if you'd just like to identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Dana Badgerow, Commissioner of Administration. Madam Chair, I had understood that before we launch into the Drive to Excellence update, you would like for me to give just a brief update as to what's happening in the Department of Administration and a little bit of a review of, very, very brief, of what we're doing and who we are. We have gone on a weight reduction program in the Department of Administration, largely due to spin-offs and elimination of activities. We have gone, in fact, from 849 employees at the beginning of last session to 485 employees today. But that is not all reduction in force. In fact, very little of it is. First of all, there were legislative changes that affected our headcount. The Environmental Quality Board power plant siting activity went to the Department of Commerce. That was 8. Obviously, the creation of the Office of Enterprise Technology, about which you're going to learn a lot this morning, spun off the Office of Technology, which was 19, and the Intertechnologies Group, which was 277. In addition, by reorganization order, the Building Codes Group went to the Department of Labor and Industry, and that was 61. The Office of Administrative Hearings went to, the Municipal Boundary Adjustment Group went to the Office of Administrative Hearings, that was 3. We did some layoffs and some reorganization in some of the former planning agency activities with a reduction of 8. And then we're pleased to say that we added 18, and we'll be adding a couple more due to the addition of the janitorial services in the new buildings. You may remember that was a competitive procurement. We went to the private sector to determine whether or not we could be doing it more efficiently with private sector resources. We did receive bids on all of those new buildings. We also allowed our internal staff to bid, provided them some contracting help, some consulting to make sure their bid was credible, and we're pleased to say that, in fact, the internal bid won. So we are adding staff for that purpose. So we have kind of reshaped ourselves in terms of we are no longer substantially in the technology business, although we do still have the Land Management Information Center. Also in your packets is a small brochure. This is hot off the presses. In fact, it's not even quite the official copy. We ran these on a color copier because our copies are not back from the printer. This is admin's strategic plan, goals, and everything having to do with who we are in a nutshell. And, in fact, this is all we have. I just want to focus on a couple of minor points concerning this document and the evolution, as we see it, of the Department of Administration. Our mission statement has changed. Our mission statement is short and sweet and simple, and it is oriented toward our customers. Previous mission statements by the Department of Administration were, quite frankly, oriented around the Department of Administration, seeking to be the best, or the leader, or the most innovative, and all those are important things, but unless we are actually serving our customers, our fellow state agencies, or the citizens that we serve, then we have no business being in business. So we have reoriented everything we have done toward those customers. If you open the booklet, we have also recast a bit what we do. And at the very top and in the very bottom in very small print is an itemized menu of the things that we do day to day. And they're not stated in lofty kinds of sounding words. They are very simple. We authenticate burial sites. We plan events in the state capitol. We manage 800 leases. We help state agencies save energy and so on. And there's a whole series, and literally this does capture the list of products and services that are available in the Department of Administration. Every employee could find themselves in there. And I think it's notable just in that we are getting down to business, and this is the business of the Department of Administration. Only one other thing I will point out, which is at the top of the second column, which are really our goals, our longer-term mission, and that is that we are driving toward a shared services organization. We're going to talk a little bit about that when we get into DRIVE. But a shared services organization is not a centralized service, and we're going to talk a lot more over the coming months and years. It is a service that is shared by the agencies whose costs are shared by the agencies, whose productivity goals and cost reduction goals are shared, whose service levels are shared, and so forth. We believe that the Department of Administration is in a really good position to model that kind of behavior, and we're starting with the services that we currently have. So with that, I think I would just pause for any questions about generally the department.
Questions for members? Representative Pan.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, I don't know how specific question you want, but particularly as we just are on here on Election Day, I'm interested in the inaccuracies in the census, and I know that there are federal constrictions against correcting the census for federal purposes, but I wonder if there are any restrictions on correcting the census for state purposes, and if we could do a correction of our undercount, which is actually a very simple statistical procedure of how you correct the undercount, which as an aside I'll point out, I learned about when I was for 1 year an undergraduate zoology major, and we did a counting of bat populations in caves, and you correct the undercounts exactly the way that you count the bat populations in caves. So.
Okay. Commissioner Bedro.
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, I confess pretty much a clean slate of ignorance with respect to bat population counts as well as the census. As you know, we have the state demographer in our department. We're honored to have him and his team, and he is the expert, and we can direct that question to him.
Okay. Any other questions for members? Okay. So this is a handout we have, right?
Yeah, this is just a copy of the slides if you want to follow along. Right. It's maybe easier to read on the handout than it might be from the slides.
Thank you.
My second request was to give an update on the Drive to Excellence. I've given a number of presentations during the regular session. There were authors of the bill that created the Office of Enterprise Technology right here on this committee, and so I'm not going to dwell on a lot of the background and why we did it, but I do want to talk about what we've done since we kicked it off. Two slides is all, just to kind of refresh. Why are we doing it, and what's the Drive to Excellence all about? Has anybody got enough money to do what they really need to do? And so we are very, very mindful of the budgetary pressures facing everyone in state and local units of government. And so we can't just keep doing the same old things with ever-constrained resources. We really must go back and look at how we are doing things and look for better ways to do them. So the budgetary pressures are there, the demand for better and faster services, better accessibility to government is there, and yet we have no money, additional money, to do it. In addition, the demographics are really profound. Over the next 10 years, 47% of us, state employees, will retire. So we also know that the workforce, the demographer tells us, the workforce coming up to replace those employees will be significantly smaller, and employees will be a scarce commodity. One more thing that I believe motivates that we reshape how we are doing a lot of the work in government. But we're not reshaping at all. And this pyramid helps to, I think, just graphically demonstrate the services that we are focusing on in the Drive to Excellence. At the pyramid, at the top, the apex, are agency-specific services, the kinds of things that the commissioner was just talking about with respect to Veterans Affairs. They know veterans. They really need to be the ones on the front line determining how those services are delivered. Similarly, the DNR or MnDOT, they know our wetlands and roads, respectively. We didn't attempt in the Drive to Excellence to do anything about reshaping or reorganizing those services. But supporting those agency-specific services are, in fact, two different kinds of services. Those that are shared, which would be the middle part of that pyramid, and those are opportunities for cooperation and sharing. And at the bottom of the pyramid, the real foundation, are what we're calling enterprise services. Those are sometimes called back office functions, the kinds of things that are the business of government, that one really should be indifferent as to where they're performed, as long as they're performed effectively with good efficiency, cost reductions in mind, and so forth. Citizens don't really care where expense reports are processed or where employee orientation is given. They really care about how they get the services that they see and that touch them. So the Drive to Excellence deals with the bottom two-thirds of that pyramid. Again, just a quick refresher on where we've come. This journey actually began a little bit over a year ago with the engagement of Deloitte Consulting. And 205 state employees involved in an effort to really scan state government, to look at how we are doing many of these functions. They also did an IT scan and a technology scan to determine what we own. That process was completed just about a year ago, in fact.
Excuse me, Representative Kahn.
Was that contract to Deloitte Consulting done on a competitive bid, and did the internal agency have an ability to bid on it?
Mr. Bedrill.
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, it was competitively bid, extremely competitively bid, and even following the selection of the successful bidder was negotiated substantially from the initial proposal. The internal consulting group, the management analysis group, was in fact involved in that process and helped design the scope of work, but deemed itself really incapable of being able to handle the scope of work of that effort. So ruled themselves out, I guess, in that sense. But we're involved and remain involved today extensively in helping us implement the Drive to Excellence. From all of these ideas, from all of these interviews, questionnaires, data scans, 400 ideas for reform came forward. And those were sifted and combined and prioritized down to 24 business cases. Those business cases were then fleshed out and developed. And you can read all of those business cases at the website, the excellence.com website. They're detailed. They deal with a whole lot of things that we aren't ready to take on right now. But we did, in fact, recommend to the governor six of those business cases for immediate implementation. Those cases, in the aggregate, do offer the opportunity for significant cost reduction, assuming we make the necessary investments to achieve those cost reductions. But quite frankly, cost reduction was not the primary goal of this effort. The primary goal of this effort was, in fact, to reshape, to restructure the way in which we perform these services. Those first six projects were kicked off on April 4th by executive order, one reorganization order, and five executive orders. And, as you all know, we moved through the legislative session with the legislation that created the Office of Enterprise Technology. And quite frankly, that was the centerpiece of what we were trying to do. Much of what Drive to Excellence deals with has information technology at its core. It is the enabler. Until we have common databases and common systems and processes, actually combining things and rationalizing them becomes almost impossible. So that creation we do thank you for, and just a little bit later you're going to hear from the state's first cabinet-level CIO, Gopal Khanna, and he will tell you all about what he's doing, so we won't steal his thunder. Now this one, I know you can't read on the screen, and so it would be probably helpful to look at your chart, but we have a very extensive governance process in place to manage the drive to excellence. It is led by a sub-cabinet that reports to the governor. I am the chair of the sub-cabinet, and I'm pleased to be that. It's populated with commissioners from various agencies, line agencies, and staff agencies. We had been meeting biweekly. We're now meeting once a month to keep track of what's going on in each of these cases. We were not given a budget to implement the Drive to Excellence. And so we have scraped together a program office staff of one. We reorganized some activities in the commissioner's office, and were able to find enough money to hire Kathy Sybil away from the Secretary of State's office. And Kathy is an experienced program manager, and she is our program director. But it is a staff of one, and she resides in our office, and you're going to hear from Kathy in just a moment. However, there are almost back up to our original count of nearly 200 employees who are involved in a variety of project teams, work groups, who are implementing these six ideas. I do want to mention, and you're also going to hear from Dan McElroy, former Chief of Staff of the Governor, who is here with us this morning, and I know you probably saw the announcement with respect to Dan's appointment as Special Advisor to the Governor in Innovation, and he will much better than I can explain what that role means, but I just want to show that he is really our worthy advisor on the Drive to Excellence, and we regard him as our external spokesperson, particularly. And so I won't, again, try to steal what the rest of Dan is going to tell you this morning. But each of these six teams, as I mentioned, has a commissioner leading it. So I'm on point and responsible to ensure that the sourcing or procurement project, as well as the real property project, move forward. The building codes and the licensing projects are being headed by Scott Brenner from the Department of Labor and Industry. Michael Campion from Public Safety is leading the grants management, and then of course Gopal Khanna, the CIO, is commissioner level leading the IT governance team. Each of those teams, as I said, has a well-defined scope statement. They have a timetable. They owe reports to the governor on December 15th. They have targets. They are not just working generics. They're down to grassroots and working issues, which I'm going to leave to Kathy Sybil to talk through the six projects. Before we do that, let me just ask stop for a moment and pause if there are any questions about how we're governing Drive to Excellence, how we're managing it, the process in general.
Well, please proceed.
Okay.
Ms. Sybil, please identify yourself for the record. Oh, excuse me. Question from Representative Khan.
I tend to like simpler structures. Why? What would change if these side things were put in the direct line instead of on the side, the senior advisor and the DTE program officer? So it was senior advisor, so it went the governor, then to the sub-cabinet, and then the program office and the project leaders.
Commissioner.
Team.
Madam Chair, Representative Khan, I think what is intended to delineate are who are the advisors and who are the decision makers. And the decision makers with respect to the Drive to Excellence are the sub-cabinet and the governor. Those off to the side, as you call it, I would call our advisors, our counselors, and are not directly in the decision-making role.
Representative Khan.
And so just eliminating them would have no effect on the decision-making role.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Khan, I can't say that. I mean, I think that there's no dearth of good ideas, and we welcome them from wherever they come, and particularly, I mean, I was thrilled when Dan McElroy was named to this role because he has enormous wealth of experience both in the private sector and in government, and he informs me regularly about, and coaches and counsels about what we should be doing here. So I value that input, so I can't say it doesn't affect the decisions.
Thank you. Ms. Sybil, welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Kathy Sybil. I'm the Program Director for the Drive to Excellence. As Commissioner Badgero said, the Governor's Executive Orders launched six projects, and I'm going to go over those six projects very briefly with you this morning.
Excuse me. Question from Representative Connor.
So the first thing that the Drive to Excellence seems to have given us is two new administrative positions, Ms. Sybil's and Mr. McElroy. So we have two new positions that didn't exist in government before, and they're now in it. Just checking on the numbers.
Commissioner Badgero, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Khan, I will say that in my case, in the case of Ms. Sybil, we did eliminate a position, and the responsibilities of that position, quite frankly, I absorbed in part. And so it is a net of zero in the case of the Department of Administration.
Okay. Let's move on. Ms. Sybil.
And then continuing.
Representative
Khan. Do the same in his staff?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Khan, no.
I'm actually sorry,
if I might, Madam Chair, Representative Khan. I believe there was an open position in the Governor's office, and that position has not been filled. So I believe, again, from a headcount perspective, it is a net zero. Sorry.
Ms. Sybil.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, one of the first projects that was launched was the Strategic Sourcing Project. What they're doing is basically re-engineering how we do purchasing here at the state. And we're looking at this project as being a very important project because it will provide the bulk of the initial cost savings for the project. I've listed a few of the items that they're currently working on and already improving cost saving. First of all, they have an increased emphasis on professional and technical contract pricing. Previously, agencies could weight the pricing on contracts basically as low as 5 to 10%, anything that they wanted. Now we're putting an emphasis on 30 to 40%, and that is a rule. Another item is once a bid is received, that then the negotiation starts. We don't accept that bid as just the final and the last offer. That's when we start asking, what else can you do for us? Can you lower the price? And these things seem like very much common sense, but they take time. You have to remember to do that. You have to take the effort. So there's training right now with the purchasing agents on remembering to do this, ask the questions, and on the price waiting. We're also implementing a new software package, which is helping us to analyze our information on how much spending we're doing. We have the vendors putting that in. We will have the first test results coming out later in this month. And basically what that's doing is it's data mining the current information that we have in the MAP system. That is our accounts payable and accounting system. There's some exciting changes coming in on office supplies. We're renegotiating those contracts, and we're taking a catalog of 30,000 items right now. So we have all these pens and staplers and other items that we can buy. 30,000 is our choices, and we're going to boil that down to about 2,800 choices. So we're making a significant difference in volume discounts. Fewer items to select from, but much greater volume discounts. And then we're going one step farther with that. We're totally eliminating the printed catalog, and so all office supply ordering will be done internet-wise. And so here again, we're taking the price of the printed catalog and putting that into our discounts. We're negotiating those contracts right now, and we hopefully will have some real exciting news coming out shortly. We're putting standards for IT commodities. They're working with laptops, desktops, and printers, first of all. And here again, we'll be leveraging volume discounts with fewer vendors and standardized equipment. And then also, they're looking at consolidating contracts. A subgroup got together and started brainstorming about all the possible contracts that they could consolidate. Came up with a large list, and now they're concentrating on maybe four or five of them to start with. There are things like lab services and roofing design and title searches, those types of things.
Excuse me, I have a question. Representative Khan.
Yes.
Madam Chairman, I had a complaint a while ago, and I'm not sure that it's still not ongoing, from a constituent about the difficulty of getting on the approved vendors list for various ones. And, for example, a question of why the state didn't use the federal approved vendors list more completely. And then the other thing, you know, I like this contract, and I see its ability to be cost, but how is that going to affect our attempt to give more business to women and minority contractors? How does that affect? How is that affected by fewer vendors and more consolidation?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn. We, too, hear the complaints about difficulties getting on the state bidders list, and we now have a concentrated outreach when we have those complaints. Send your constituent to us, and we will work with them to facilitate their getting on the list. If it's just a case of understanding the requirements, filling out the right paperwork, and so forth, we'd be happy to help. With respect to the targeted and minority businesses, we intend to preserve our current programs and preferences with respect to women and minority-owned businesses. I have one data point, which is the state of New Mexico, which has recently gone through, and they're a little bit further along with their sourcing consolidation. They actually increased, and I don't know that just by simply paying attention to it and being mindful of it, increased their award of businesses to New Mexico businesses as well as to those in the targeted groups as a result of the consolidation. And I think it's just a case of you've got to be mindful of it and not let it get off the radar screen.
Anything further, Representative Kahn? We have a question from Representative Neil Peterson.
Thank you. Of course, this is very exciting in most corporate entities when you get into purchasing. Can you quantify this numerically for me? And then, secondly, do you have an expectation of benefit from it? What kind of number are we talking about in purchasing? And this has got to be an enormous number, and there's probably some expectation. Can you share that with us?
Madam Chair and Representative Peterson, we know, again, other states' experience, but we can all, and, of course, the Deloitte recommendations quantified it as well. Our experience is bound to be different, but we are, of course, talking many, many millions of dollars. The Deloitte report suggested that if we were to implement all of the changes, and some of it does require some investment that we are not currently prepared to make in either systems or consulting help, the run rate would be $55 million a year. And, of course, then there's a separate issue around the savings that are available in the IT area. We know of states that have saved upwards of $100 million a year. At least they report that they have. So we know that the number is big. We have, obviously, we know that the need is big, and so we will be quantifying our savings as we go along and reporting them. But at the moment, we only have the Deloitte assessment and what other states have done. We're taking it commodity by commodity, and as we do that, for example, on office supplies, we believe we will get an X percent discount on $8 million worth of spend every year, and depending on how those negotiations go, we can quantify what that X percent is.
So it's quite significant.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, it is.
Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, I was intrigued by the changing in the professional technical contracts and your earlier comment about how the internal bid for janitorial services beat out the private sector in a head-to-head kind of competition. And does this revamping of the process also allow for increased use of that opportunity for internal staff to bid on that? Because I've often heard from professional employees that, you know, their commissioner or someone is approached by an outside vendor, or we could do this for you, that for you, and you know, it raises expectations and interest, and yet it's a project that internal professional staff would love to have an opportunity to devote time and energy and talent to, and yet so often that isn't even considered. It goes to an outside vendor. And is this process change going to open up more opportunities for that examination of what can our current employees do?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I think not in and of itself. Of course, you know there is currently required a certification when an agency seeks a professional and technical contract that no state agency employee is capable of doing the work. I'm just going to speculate here, and please forgive me, but it is pure speculation on my part. I believe that once we reach an enterprise view of especially the IT world, when we are operating as an enterprise and we have an enterprise team capable of doing a lot of these IT functions, that we will see that we do in fact have critical mass. Whereas if you look at the IT resources agency by agency, they would not necessarily have the critical mass nor the common goal and mission to support the enterprise. So I believe there's opportunity there, but perhaps that's a question you could reserve for Commissioner Khanna.
Okay, please proceed.
Licensing's goal is to improve its convenience to the citizen by creating a uniform place for them to go to get their licenses. A survey was taken in which 85% said that they would like to be able to get their licenses online. In all actuality, right now, only about 18% of licensing transactions actually are online. So we've got a huge opportunity. But before we go to a one-stop licensing shop, we are looking at a quick hit, customer portal. As I said, we currently have a few licenses that are online. We want to make a one-page website that citizens can go to right now and easily get to the licenses that are online. And we hope to have that up and running by approximately the end of the year. So that's our quick hit. The licensing project also is breaking new ground in how they're gathering their information. They held a three-day vendor forum last month in which about 20 vendors actually came to us to give us information. They held roundtable discussions and gave presentations on how to approach the project, implementation strategies, their architecture, business cases that they've done with other customers. So now they've got a mountain of information. They're going to boil that down. They're going to analyze it and use that information for a request for proposal and RFP. All licensing is going to be reevaluated. Currently, we have about 500 different license types in the state, and we're going to ask, do we need all of them? How can we reevaluate those? How can we boil them down? And then some of the licenses need a test. A nursing license or an education license, you have to take an exam. Some of the exams right now are outsourced to third-party vendors, but not all of them. And we're going to be looking at outsourcing all of the exams so we get out of that business. With grant management, the state currently manages about $1.1 billion worth of incoming grant funds from about 500 different sources. And then the state turns around and issues grants, about 9,000 different grants to about 7,000 different organizations. And then they have to monitor all those grants. And each agency does it a little bit differently. So here again, there's a huge opportunity for an enterprise-wide way of doing it and an enterprise-wide system. The steering team for this project has been somewhat innovative in what they're using a current organization called the Enterprise Grant Management Community. This community has representatives from all the major agencies that manage grants. This agency has come up with a 20-step process for managing grants. They looked at all the commonality among the agencies, and they've identified all the differences. So they've already done a gap analysis. Their next step, then, is to put together a legislative package to go along with this 20-step process, and then to put an RFP together, a request for proposal for a new system.
Excuse me, I have a question on that. Commissioner, as you talk about this grant management project and the civil, I'm thinking of... LCMR this fall has that task force that's looking at the reorganization of how the Environmental Trust Fund grants are distributed. And I'd be interested in doing some follow-up with you and your group to find out how that might tie in with that task force work this fall.
Madam Chair, sure. We'd be pleased. As you know, the goal of this project is to, first of all, institute standard or common ways of doing things. Every agency kind of does it their own way today. Secondly, obviously, then to get efficiencies by going to an enterprise approach. What the agencies found was that there were, of these 20 steps, there were commonalities in almost every area except one, payments. No two agencies do payments the same. So to the extent that we're able to come up with more efficient and common processes, we'd be happy to share them.
Great. Question from Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. I happen to have been involved in a project with the Department of Health, which funds county public health agencies, and they had a year-long look at their grants management process. And I would hope you'd look at local government grants maybe separately from the ones that you do for nonprofits or for particular services, because what we found there is instead of getting block grants, which was true in the 70s, we evolved into specific grants to the point that some public health agencies were having to deal with 30 to 40 different contracts and grants with the state with very different reporting requirements, which was causing real problems at the local level, because one grant would say we want the data by children age 5 to 9, and the other one would say, well, we want 7 to 12 broken out separately. And so even just common data collection systems were impossible at the local level. And after this year-long effort, which involves state agency staff, local staff, county commissioners, we were able to come up with a master contract from uniformity, and I would hope that that kind of innovative work would actually feed into this. But it really made efforts at the local level to have a comprehensive approach to public health much more effective and really strengthen the partnership, where I think where local governments are our partners in delivering services, we really need to look at not just what the impact is on state efficiency, but what the impact is on the local government efficiencies as well.
Thank you. Madam Chair and Representative, I just wanted to add that on the steering team and on the sub-work group teams, they do have people from the nonprofit organizations and from the counties and the city level.
Representative Neil Pearson.
I guess it's really a comment, not a question, but in both of these last two, licensing and this one, again, from my perception, it really will make the state look like we have our act together. I mean, I've heard people in licensing talk about, why don't you guys get your act together? Because people had to go to so many different agencies. And the same with granting. And I'm elated to hear this because, again, the perception of how we deliver services and how we interact with people that we administer is a huge impact. The perception should be great. I want this to succeed. Just a comment.
Madam Chair,
Mr.
Representative Peterson, if I might, just to give you a more concrete example, if one were to start a restaurant in the state of Minnesota today, and assuming that the restaurant needed a liquor license but didn't have an elevator, one would need to go to 8 different places to obtain business licenses or permits. With at least even creation of this portal, we have the ability to say, do you want to start a restaurant? Click here. And it will lead you electronically to those 8 different places. Now, of course, until we get systems commonality, we can't do much more than that. But I think it just as Ms. Sybil referred to it, will be a quick hit, and I think it will be visible to our citizens.
Great. Question from Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. I echo Representative Peterson's comment. I think it's very exciting, but my question is, why are we getting out of the business of the third-party exams? It seems to me that you would have another option of pulling them all in and doing the same kind of process with them that you're attempting to do with the licensing process itself. Could you just address that, please?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, and this is for sure not my area of expertise, so I'm going to overshoot my headlights just a little bit, but my understanding is that a good proportion of the exams are done outsourced today. Looking at the cost of delivery, the effectiveness, the necessity to upgrade those tests as laws change, there are vendors who do that every day as part of their regular business. It's not the business of state government to give exams of that sort. So what we found is that just for effectiveness and better cost, the third parties are, in fact, better. It's not to say that there, in every single case, we won't still be doing some tests internally. And that analysis has not even been done. And so that work still has to come.
Thank you. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. On the third-party outsourcing of tests, one question that I do have is, are there going to be restrictions on the outside parties who administer those tests that they can't also provide test-taking preparation courses, because at times some of these businesses can do a preparation course in which they pretty much give you the answers to their own tests. And I think that really takes the integrity down of the licensing process.
Ms. Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative Hodge, point very well taken. And again, we'll make sure to share that with the team that's working on it.
Great. Well, please proceed.
The Building Codes Project is involved in consolidating five different business code units into one division at the Department of Labor and Industry. Last May, their responsibilities and their accountability were combined, and then over the summer and early this fall, the five units were physically moved over to the Department of Labor and Industry on Lafayette. And in fact, last week, the last building codes and inspection unit was actually physically moved over there, so they're all housed together in one building. They have a new name. They're called the Construction Codes and Licensing Division. They will be hiring a new director in December and then holding a grand opening house celebration in January. So as well as physically moving together, they're also working on their processes so that they work better together as a whole. The real property project is...
Excuse me, a question from Representative Kahn.
Just keeping track of these FTAs, does that new... Division director, is that an addition to state government, or is there any reduction that gives us that new director position?
Ms. Sybil?
I don't know at this time, but I can find out that information and let you know.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, I will...
And another question.
Excuse me, Representative Kahn.
Then is that... I guess I'm also interested in when we're changing positions, and clearly it doesn't hold for the governor's office, but how many of these, what changes are made from civil service positions to political appointment positions?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, with respect to the drive to excellence, I have to say that Ms. Sybil is not a permanent employee. She is a Rule 10 employee because we believe this project will has a limited life. We'll get to the implementation of the 24 cases. Other than that, no employee status has changed. All of the Office of Enterprise Technology employees went over to their new agency with their current statuses intact. With respect to the codes, I did want to just comment if I might. One of the basic, there are many, many reasons to do the code consolidation, the primary one of which is to make it easier for our construction contractors and those who have to interpret code and to get consistent applications and interpretations of the code and a one-stop shop for all of your code issues. But in addition, the co-location of all of these groups does result in efficiencies. And it is, they will be sharing, for example, a single receptionist. Their training facilities will be shared. And in the course of that, there will be headcount reductions through the code consolidation. But if you'll remember when I testified before, the goal of the Drive to Excellence is not headcount reduction, but it is to help begin to reshape things with the coming retirements. We do intend and hope to manage most of the reductions through attrition.
Thank you. Please proceed.
The real property project's goal is to identify the best use of the state's property. Currently, there are 22 different custodial agencies that manage up to 5,000 different buildings and 6 million acres of land. And, of course, all the agencies do it differently. Some have systems. Some have Excel spreadsheets in their drawers. So there's a little bit of disparity between all the different agencies and actually how they manage it. There are 9 custodial agencies that are on the steering team. They're working collaboratively. They are currently putting together all their requirements and hope to have enough information to put an RFP together by the end of the year, early January. They're gathering information from other states. They're seeing what systems other states are using, what some of the best practices are that other states do. And also, they are open to the possibility of outsourcing wherever they can. For instance, if there's a property management vendor who can do it better, faster, cheaper than we can, they're open to investigating that. The 6th project.
Madam, pardon me, Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman and Ms. Sybil, how do you deal with really complicated landholders with multiple different financial accounts like DNR, for example?
Ms. Sybil, if you'd answer that, please.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, that's what we're fleshing out right now with the requirements, and we are finding that there's a big difference between DNR's wetlands, how they manage that, as opposed to how MnDOT manages their right-of-ways, as opposed to the land that's underneath these buildings. So at this point, we're still looking at our scope and what our requirements are.
That do for now? Ms. Sybil, please continue. Thanks.
The sixth project is information technology governance, and this is really the backbone of all the other projects. Gopal Hanna will be giving you much more information about this project later. But basically, the state's technology is currently looking at agency-specific needs and not looking at a full enterprise-wide view. And because of that, there's a lot of disparity and duplication, some efficiencies. And some of the statistics that I have are that we have over 500 different websites, over 1,000 networks, and even 7 different email systems within the state. So there's a lot of duplication and differences. To start the reforms, legislation was passed last May in which the state CIO position was elevated to a commissioner level. And also, as you saw on the governance structure, the commissioner is on the Drive to Excellence sub-cabinet. The new Office of Enterprise Technology was formed, and this is a combination of the old Office of Technology and Enterprise Services. They have 14 different project teams working right now to re-engineer all their processes. They're looking at everything from architecture to security to project management. And just to give you an idea of how much energy, how much involvement is going on, the IT procurement team has 12 different sub-teams in which they represent 19 different agencies and have over 60-some people working on it. So there's a lot of energy, there's a lot of involvement happening right now with the OET.
Commissioner Badger. I'd like to get just a couple of wrap-up slides, and
please.
Then we'd like to turn it over to the CIO, because there is a lot going on, and I think you'll be interested to see some of that detail. But let me just talk about the next steps very briefly. This is not a short-term project. The Drive to Excellence roadmap shows implementation through 2010. We'd like to accelerate some of that. We think we can get some of that done earlier than 2010. But it is a methodical culture change for state government. It's basically asking us all in state government to change the way we think and not to think so much that we're in this silo, but that we are connected, that all agencies are here to serve state government, not to serve their own agency purposes. So this culture change will require a lot of involvement, and you can see we already have tons of people involved on the various teams. But just recently we formed a separate team of the deputy commissioners. Each agency has a deputy who tends to know as much or more about what's going on in the agency than the commissioner themselves. These deputies meet monthly, and we decided to take advantage of that meeting and their knowledge of their agencies to form them as our change management and communications group. And so they've been chartered to work within their agency, to talk about what's going on in Drive, to alleviate the fear and anxiety that employees may have about it, to help inform what it's really all about and what it's trying to do. And just recently, we're very proud to say that the Target Corporation has agreed to help facilitate that group. So we're getting a lot of help from a lot of fronts. Public awareness and support is important. This is a start here today to begin to pique your interest about what's going on, but we're going anywhere and everywhere. As I mentioned earlier, our chief spokesperson, Dan McElroy, has already given any number of speeches, and he'll tell you a little bit more about what that's going to look like. Obviously, we want you to own these ideas. We don't think they're partisan. We think they are basically good government, doing things the way they really should be, and as Representative Peterson indicated, the way big business has done, small business as well, for some time. We're trying to catch up to those modern business practices. And then again, partnerships and communication. We are doing this, as I mentioned earlier, and we are constrained by the fact that we don't have a lot of money. The state of Illinois spent $62 million on a variety of consultants for real property and sourcing and others. Makes ours look pretty good by contrast, but that $62 million was spent on actually implementation, consultants hand-holding the agencies through a lot of this change. We're doing it on our own. And while that's constraining and it may affect the speed with which we're able to do it, we actually think that there's a real benefit to that, because the people who are designing these programs, coming up with the ideas and the implementation plans, are the people in the agencies, the state employees, who are going to have to make them work. So it's kind of a mixed blessing in that sense. Again, I mentioned that we do have key legislators, many of you on this committee, who've bought into this concept, and we want to continue to thank you for that support and to help encourage others. But I think Representative Peterson said it best, the citizens really do want more from state government. And regrettably, there are other states who have moved out ahead of us in some of these areas. So we are playing catch-up, but we're going to catch up fast. I will say that no other state has undertaken this comprehensive a review. Many have done sourcing reform, real property reform. None has taken on a set of 24 business cases, or even six, as we've taken on here at the outset. So we think we have the ability to catch up very quickly. So I think with that, it ends my presentation.
Okay, I have several members with questions. First on the list is Representative Beard.
Madam Chair and Commissioner Badgerow, good ideas are happening here, things I think that are long overdue in looking at the way we do the business of government. But it is being implemented by the administration. Do you have the statutory authority you need to make sure that it survives administrations and continues forward?
Commissioner Badgerow.
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, of course that's a concern of the team. This was and is a key tenet of the Pawlenty-Molnau administration. It's where the ideas originated. But I believe firmly that these ideas are taking root. We had strong bipartisan support in the session for the creation of the Office of Enterprise Technology. So I like to think that a good idea, again, as I said earlier, is not partisan. We hope that it has enough roots that no matter what should happen in the next election, it will survive. We believe that a lot of the leadership of these teams are state employees who are not political appointees, and that they believe passionately. If you were to have the project manager for the grants management team come talk to you, you would be a believer after about 5 minutes, because this guy is so committed. So I think those are our best chances for success. And at the bottom line, if the public demands it, I think that will make a difference as well.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Next up is Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Badgerow, I'm going to refer back to some series of questions, I guess, posed by Representative Kahn primarily about additional positions and different changes. Could you talk about your overall budget in the Department of Administration, total dollars you've had with some of the changes you've had? I think the implication and maybe the question that we have is, as we're adding these, are we growing or are we not?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, my general fund budget for the Department of Administration is really relatively small. It's about $10.5 million. And we did take a 9% reduction in the general fund appropriation this last session. I don't think we're unusual, and I'm not whining, but I mean, we are doing this with reduced headcount in every case, as are the rest of the state agencies who are dedicating. None of these people who are working on the team, with the exception of Ms. Civil and the Real Property Project Manager, which is being funded by the nine agencies, they all have regular jobs and are continuing to do those regular jobs. And so it's asking a lot of employees. So I think that's my reflection on the headcount. We continue to cut.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Badgerow, that was my understanding. I think I've had a conversation with you about this before, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to say that. I really applaud what you're doing. In my business life and my small businesses, I've attempted to do these sorts of things as the owner and chief bottle washer. You do these things, and there's just a lot of things to look for in the nooks and crannies, and you're taking on a huge task here, and I know it's been ongoing for a couple of years. I've been very fascinated. I've been over to your department, talked to some of the people. And I really applaud what you're doing, and I know you're doing this. I know there's some positions being added, and there's some changes going on. But my perception has also been you've been doing it with, if anything, a smaller budget than you've had before. And that is doing more with less, and I think it's a great compliment. And I look forward to seeing the further results of this. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Next up is Representative Kahn.
Yes, Madam Chairman and Commissioner. You know, I always like things to go right, but when they go wrong, I'm always interested in pointing the blame properly. And one of the things, and I'm not quite sure how it works, the part of the statute that goes from 16E.03, really since 16E.0465 probably, which is the whole concept of the final responsibility for any technology project, or at least any technology project over a certain amount, where the final approval goes to the Commissioner of Administration, or I guess at some point we made it the Governor or the Governor's designee, although I think the Governor had always designated the Commissioner of Administration. Where does that final blame get laid now? Is it the Commissioner of Administration, or is it the CIO, or is it the Governor?
Sounds like a loaded question. Commissioner.
Madam Chair, on
that. Well, it's not loaded if everything goes right. Then the phrase goes quick.
Madam Chair, Representative Conn, and perhaps Mr. Shepherd could help me here, but my understanding is that all authority, and it is considerably increased authority beyond what used to exist, for information technology has been transferred from the Commissioner of Administration to the State Chief Information Officer, who is a direct appointee of the Governor.
Mr. Shepherd, do you have anything to add to that? Okay. The next up on the list is Representative Neil Peterson.
Oh, Mr. Madam Chairman.
Excuse me.
And that includes the ability of, so how, who tells, one of the final hammer in this, I would guess, is that the Commissioner of Finance unencumbers appropriations. Who gets to do that? Who gets to tell the Commissioner of Finance to do it? And what happens if the Commissioner of Finance doesn't do it?
Commissioner Bedrow.
Madam Chair, Representative Conner, can't answer the last, what happens if the Commissioner of Finance, but my understanding is that that is the authority of the Chief Information Officer, and we're going to get him up here in just a moment, and so you can explore that concept further with him if you like.
Okay, we have two more members' questions. Next up, Representative Neil Peterson.
Mine's really kind of simple. You, in your comments several times, referred to this program as DRIVE. You just used the name DRIVE. So if from now on I use the word DRIVE, that means inclusively all that you're doing. And I would hope that that'd be class five letters, and, you know, and it strikes a chord with me, so the fifth note in the chord would be the seventh. So I like that. Let's go. And so I can use the word DRIVE, and we'll know what it means.
Mr. Bedrow.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, absolutely.
Okay, next up, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Badger. I just, I was thinking something along the lines of what Representative Beard asked, but I didn't think it would be polite for me to say that, but I'm glad you did raise that, and I just wanted to congratulate you and say that I'm really impressed with what I've seen. And so I hope that you're right, that if there is a change of administration, that a lot of what you've been working on would survive and continue, because I agree with you. I think a lot of it is not partisan, and you know, the world seems to be ever more sort of rapidly changing, and I think we have to be constantly trying to improve our ability to respond to those changes and even get ahead of them a little bit as we can, and I think we're going to be called on ever more to do that. So I just wanted to thank you for what I see as very good leadership for the state.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, I do have to deflect that a bit. This is a committed sub-cabinet. This is a shared leadership. And so while, you know, we're managing the day-to-day through the Department of Administration, there is a huge amount of commitment to this project. And so I'm not alone in leading the project by any means.
Thank you.
Having said that,
anything further, Commissioner?
This is probably a good chance for me to introduce Gopal Khanna. And just as he's coming up here, he's probably too modest to tell you this, so I'm going to introduce him as he's walking up. This is a man who has been both in private and public sector, both in IT and in general management, but most recently served as the CIO of the Peace Corps, and came to us from that position directly. We're just thrilled to have him. He joined us in mid-August to implement the statute, and I think he'll be excited to see what he's been doing.
Welcome, Commissioner Khanna, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Gopal Khanna, the state CIO.
Welcome.
I'm indeed honored and privileged to be here, Madam Chair and members of the committee. and to add an IT perspective to what Commissioner Badger has already talked about, she has been a tireless champion of transformation and drive to excellence. I've watched that for the last 83 days. I've been on the job 83 days, and it's been a delightful 83 days, I must admit. Delightful and exciting, because I believe sincerely that we have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to make a huge difference for our state. I've just returned from a trip to California attending and meeting the National CIO Conference, where I met with my colleagues from other states, from New York to California to Michigan to Iowa to South Dakota to Delaware and Wisconsin, people who are doing great work. All the states seem to be very committed and concerned at the same time about the changes that are happening in our state as well. Number one, that our workforce will be retiring in large numbers in 10 years. 47% is a huge number. It can have a huge disruptive impact on the delivery of our services, whether it be DNR, DHS, or any agency. We are also concerned about what the expectations of the citizens of the future are, our children, how they expect the delivery of services, whether it be from banking, from insurance companies, or any service or agency or organization, and for that matter, government as well. There's no question that going forward, we'll have to position ourselves and be competitive. What I discovered during my visit with my fellow commissioners at this National Association of CIOs conference was that we are behind the curve. There are many states that are well ahead on their journey to transform and modernize their operations so that they can better deliver the services that agencies render. At the end of the day, we are not in technology business, ladies and gentlemen. We are in the business to serve our citizens. I'm honored and privileged to have this opportunity to serve the governor. As a first-generation immigrant American who arrived here with $8 in his pocket, it's the ultimate tribute to have an opportunity to serve one's country and one state. So I feel humbled to be here today and to talk to you about some of my observations and add to the perspective, the IT perspective, to what the commissioner has talked about. And she has been a tireless leader, I must admit, and I hold her in great esteem for that. If you'll allow me, Madam Chair, if I can draw a couple of pictures and share with you what my observations are.
Please.
The way I see it, I, as the state CIO, must take into consideration three major pieces and components. One is the intent of the statute as passed by the legislature. And I, again, compliment this committee members and the entire legislature for the magnificent work you've done, because you really have set the stage for transformation of our state. It is utterly important that we do that, because if we do not, we will not be competitive. We will not be able to deliver our services the way your intent is. It is loud and clear to me that the governor is totally and completely on board. He looked straight into my eyes when I met him and said, Gopal, and I asked him, Governor, if there was one thing I could do for you, what would that be? He said, put in place processes so that we can conduct the business of government and deliver ever-improving services to our citizens. Not one-time improvement, but ever-improving services, because he recognizes that technology is a driver by itself, because it is changing furiously at a fast pace. And if we do not incorporate technology in leveraging our business processes, we cannot deliver better services to our citizens. Doctor's office cannot do it. A dentist's office cannot do it. Schools cannot do it. Private sector cannot do it. Banks cannot do it. Insurance companies cannot do it. As a matter of fact, I come from the private sector and I've seen firsthand how miserably the insurance industry performed. I love my insurance industry. However, as compared to the banks, we sat on our laurels for years and decades and did not improve our services. The result is ReliaStar got taken over by ING from Holland.
Mm-hmm.
Money Financial Services got taken over by AXA. The French and the European companies are doing much better. 15, 20 years ago, our insurance industry had a dominant share of the world market. We have taken a hit because we failed in the insurance industry to improve our processes and deliver the services to our customers in a more cost-effective manner. We failed to improve the productivity. On the contrary, in the banking industry, thanks to John Reed's leadership at Citibank some 25 years ago, they took the lead, and thanks to IBM in our own backyard in Rochester inventing the AS400 family of machines, they transformed the back offices and improved the banking operations. Lo and behold, came out the plastic card and ATM and banking services, revolutionized. American banks today globally have a commanding position. We in the state are not in the business of technology. However, we have to leverage technology to improve our business processes so we can service the citizens better. The third component, the way I see it, is drive to excellence. Coming from outside, and if I put on my consulting hat, I compliment this committee, the legislature, all of you, and Commissioner Badger for the leadership, because this is a fine piece of work. It has identified opportunities for transformation and change where we can indeed become better. As I compare our state with other states, having met fellow CIOs, we are behind the curve. That's an honest to God truth and fact, and a reality that we must deal with. However, we have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to literally catapult and jump and once again assume a leadership position. We must be globally competitive. We must be providing our services better. Coming in as head of OET, my charter was to take two entities and merge them, the old ITG and Office of Technology. We have done that on August 15th. Thereafter, our mission is to take the intent of the statute and operationalize it. Basically, what the statute is saying is that today we are operating at this level, approximately 7 million or so in shared services. What the statute is saying is that we should up the shared services components so that agencies can focus on unique applications and their unique business processes and not get encumbered by what can be a shared service. It is similar to what happened in our country 100 years ago. Pillsbury, Cargill, 3M, all owned their power plants because power plants gave them a competitive advantage. But by 1930s, as utilities were being delivered in a more uniform manner, they could basically move to a utility concept and get away from managing power plants. That was not their business. What you have done by passing this bill is basically set the tone that we need to do the same thing in government agencies as well. We need to take away the IT platforms in a utility mode where we can focus the agency's business on what they are supposed to be doing, which is serve the citizens better and focus on the programming side. Having said that, there are three approaches that we have embarked upon. Number one, focus on the process. We have identified in collaboration with the agencies that we serve what are mission critical processes that we must put in place, because at the end of the day, it is about processes, not about technology. We are not in technology business. If we have robust processes, we can indeed move in that direction. The second challenge I have is to leverage the skills and talents that we currently have. We are blessed to have a wonderful Minnesota workforce that has come forth and is excited about change. And finally, what we need to do is we need to identify our projects together with the tie-in with the drive to excellence and deliver better services to our citizens. Our focus is process-centric, and as we look to build the processes, we'll be achieving your intent of having improved IT governance over a period of time. And as we build the utility model, what we are doing is basically providing a mechanism whereby we can improve productivity and reduce the cost of operations so that we can, on an ongoing basis, provide higher and better values to our citizens. From OET's perspective, Madam Chair, members of the committee, what we look to achieve is basically this. As has been just discussed, at the end of the day, it's all about citizens being served. We've talked about in the private sector for many years what is referred to as e-commerce. corporation to sit from business to consumers, from business to business relationship. The commissioner talked about the total e-licensing capabilities. When the citizens approach us and want to get services, they want to get them. They do not care where the services are, which agency is serving them. What they want to do is get the services very efficiently and quickly, and especially the second generation that has grown up with technology. It will be more so. But when we talk about e-government, there are two major pieces that we need to be aware of. One is cyber security, and the other one is identity management. There are huge concerns, not only should be a huge concern, not only to us in our state, but are also great concerns to all the CIOs from all over the country. These are two subjects that are great concerns, because a couple of years ago, cybersecurity was simply a matter of dealing with young teenagers or some bright guy sitting somewhere halfway around the world or somewhere and hacking the computer. Today, it is organized crime. We need to be concerned about it. Going forward, we have to make major investments to ensure that our citizens' data and information is secure. Our challenge is to make sure that each agency focuses on its own businesses while we support them by providing a utility model. What that involves is merging data centers, combining them and optimizing them so that indeed we can realize the efficiencies and reduce the cost of operation. It requires us looking at IT acquisitions and optimizing. It's a huge opportunity for us in the state where we can aggregate and acquire our IT services, whether it be hardware, software, staffing resources or projects, in a more cost-effective manner. What we're talking about is basically a huge change and transformation at all levels, a cultural change, as I would say. And we have a unique opportunity. The legislation allows us that opportunity, and with your support, I believe we can achieve it. I would be delighted to answer any questions you have, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. I was just commenting that this has been the first time in our committee meeting we've had the design on the flip charts there, so that's been very interesting. Thank you. The interactive presentation. Questions from members? Representative Khan.
Well, Madam Chairman, I know this is the one thing that you can't be blamed for because it only happened in 85 days, and I'm not sure my facts are exactly correct, but I understand it certainly fits along with the time scale of this administration, though. I understand that the last time the Brown University did a report on e-government and compared the states, that the state of Minnesota was second. And I understand that they've just released a recent report where the state of Minnesota is 42nd, which is an enormous drop. Now, I apologize if those numbers are wrong or if the dates are wrong or anything like that, because it's just something I'm trying to remember that somebody told me. But what's the true story there, and why has this happened, and what can we be doing about it?
Madam Chair, Representative Khan, you're absolutely right. We have dropped to number 42. And that's pathetic, I'm going to be honest with you. There's no reason why in Minnesota...
What are the 8 states below them?
It is... number 42 is pathetic. The truth of the matter is we have an opportunity. We are the state where the fastest computer in the world was manufactured, Cray Research. We had Burroughs, CDC, and in our own backyard. We were, up until 30 years ago, the leaders in technology until when we lost the edge to Silicon Valley. There's no reason why we should be the number 42. I think we have an opportunity to really make an investment and improve our capabilities to deal with the citizen services, and we must do that.
Follow-up, Representative Khan?
What are the reasons for why it happened, and what are the thoughts for how we're going to do it? Then I have another question following up on the issue of security. Are there any specific issues we can do as a state?
Commissioner Khan.
Madam Chair, Representative Khan, my quick assessment, and again I've been here 83 days without getting caught into bits and bytes of the situation as to what happened, I believe that we've not made a concerted effort and investment. Private sector has made major investments in technologies to be able to position them for the future. and to be competitive in the global marketplace. Having been to California and met with my fellow commissioners, it is loud and clear that they are making major investments in their technologies, platforms, to be able to position the government agencies to serve their citizens better. We need to do the same thing. So we need to have a coherent plan going forward and be able to implement them.
Well,
Representative Khan.
Well, the next question is the cybersecurity issue. And one of the major, as I understand it, one of the major problems with identity theft is the use of the social security number. And I understand the worst, the federal government is the worst place in requiring that to be used. I just recently got old enough to get my Medicare card and discovered that my Medicare identity, which they told me to carry with me at all times, and I discovered that my Medicare identity number is my social security number when the security people said never carry that with you. So, but someone also pointed out that there are many insurance companies in Minnesota that require on paper that goes everywhere the social security number. Can we do state legislation to prohibit that kind of, to prohibit the dissemination of the social security number and the protection of it?
Mr. Khanna.
Madam Chair, Representative Khan, we have just launched a major consulting initiative, engaging a consulting firm to help us identify all the issues relative to cybersecurity, and we hope to have sometime in December, January timeframe, the outcome of that report basically giving us all the issues and what might be remedial strategies. So we will be in a position to respond to that hopefully soon.
And then
follow-up
at the national meeting of CIOs, did this issue of the federal abuse of the social security number come up at all?
Madam Chair, not specifically, but overall the issue was discussed about identity management and cybersecurity. It's an issue of great concern all over the country, both at the federal level as well as at the state level.
Thank you. Any further questions from members? Oh, Vice Chair Severson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Khan. I just wanted to follow up Representative Khan's question on going from second to 42nd. Do you have the information on when we were second?
Commissioner Khan.
Madam Chair, sir, I'm afraid I do not have that exact information, but I'd be delighted to get that for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And perhaps Representative Khan has that information. A hope, maybe, yeah.
We better get some
negative.
Let's get some factual data on that. I hate to have that hearsay flying around the committee meeting here. Okay.
Sorry, I apologize in advance.
No problem. Representative Lilly.
Madam Chair and Mr. Khan, kind of speaking to the IT acquisitions that you're speaking of here, you mentioned some great companies we have in the state of Minnesota, IBM and Cray, and some of the work that they've been able to do. In recent past, we've had an issue where the state of Minnesota's decided to go elsewhere to purchase an airplane, for example. I was just wondering, how are we doing on this? Are we going to look in Minnesota? You know, I'm reading the flattening, what is that book? Everybody's reading it, so I had to read it because my Republican brother was reading it, so I got to find out what you guys are studying. But anyways, are we going to look in Minnesota to do some of this acquisition, or are we going elsewhere, or what are we doing? Like, I hate to see us do what we did with this airplane.
Commissioner Khanna.
Madam Chair, Representative Sir, we are at this point looking to totally optimize our IT acquisition strategies, looking end-to-end processing in collaboration with the Commissioner of Administration and her team. The intent over here is to basically see if we can leverage our acquisition capabilities and see if we can and optimize our buying power as a state. We do business with Minnesota companies, and we continue to do that. And our intent is to optimize our IT acquisition process end-to-end and bring the best results for our agencies and for our state.
Okay. A couple more questions. Next up, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and CA O'Connor. At one time, we had an organization called ISAC. I think it was the Intergovernmental Information Services Advisory Committee. I'm not quite sure acronyms live longer than what they stand for. But it was a way to bring representatives of local government together with the state on planning for IT interfaces. And while the state is looking at it internally, I know in county government, where almost every service is mandated by the state, it has caused major disruptions and sometimes often major expense, sometimes loss of data that was used internally to manage it whenever the state has imposed a new information system requirement that all counties are required to use. And I know other local governments have often experienced that as well. Sometimes it has really improved our business model and our information, but sometimes it has made major expenses at the local level that I don't think the people at the state were planning and had thought through because there wasn't that sort of partnership. And I would just like to advise you that if that group doesn't exist, that as you roll out beyond sort of looking at the internal things like all the different email systems and those sorts of things, as you look more broadly to look at the information structure, to really look at that interface between the state government and its local government customers who are required to use those same servers and same processes, and really figure out what is the most effective structure for you to get that local input. Because I think that's really an important interface, and oftentimes the system that's going to work best for Coochiching County isn't necessarily going to be the best for Hennepin. We know there's got to be compromises along, but I think if you go into it knowing what those trade-offs are and maybe accommodating some of the different levels of management sophistication in the design from the front end, we'd actually end up with a better system for everybody. And so I think that committee went away. I think, you know, as part of, you know, why do we have all these commissions? But I think as we're revamping and rethinking our whole IT structure, that's an important part of our customer base, and I'd hope when you get to that phase of the process, you look at it. I think this is an impressive model, and I wish you well.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you so much. Your point is well taken, and we will look into that. I do not know the specific status of the committee that you're talking about, but I'll certainly get back to you. I do want to add that over the last 2.5 months, we have engaged agencies, large and small, and our desire is to go beyond the agencies to the local counties and boards, etc., to get them involved, because as we put together the governance program, it should be thoughtful, it should be in consideration and cooperation with the agencies. I'm really pleased to report that several commissioners have come forth and have contributed their staff hugely in building these processes that I talk about. Commissioner Goodnow, Commissioner Salamone, Commissioner Campion, Commissioner Badgerow, Commissioner Corrigan, they've all been extremely supportive of the effort, and we will be reaching out to Minskew and to counties and boards as we expand our reach, because the challenge and the opportunity over here is to come up with one program for our state, and it requires collaboration, and I'm really pleased to report that we have received tremendous collaboration. Over 118 people from 25 agencies as we speak right now are engaged in building these processes, so it truly will be a reflective of an enterprise-wide effort.
Okay, we have one further question for these two presenters. Representative Khan.
Yes. Madam Chairman, I'm a little concerned about the issue, and maybe it was even brought up in the previous presentation, about the concentration on price and, that that's going to be very important in the bidding. And specific example where I think we've really lost a great deal of service and where we're not considering the price to the people who are trying to use it is the Department of Natural Resources reservation system, which has been contracted it out first to a firm, and I guess it used to be at every park system, and I do understand why that was not an efficient model, but it was done by an outside firm in California. It's now being done, I think, by an outside firm in South Dakota on the basis of some kind of low bid. I mean, I think that's something that could be really redesigned to have us get more effective. I did talk to one person working in one of the parks who felt that, for example, she could do it for the entire region much more effectively with much better information given to people. Plus the fact that for some of the popular things that have to be reserved, you can reserve them a year in advance. So on that day, anyone wants to reserving it, just spend their time on their phone hitting the redial button. And so there are all kinds of, you know, it's not just the efficiency to the state, but it's also to the efficiency to the people using the state. And we were told by someone who had the reservation, this was for a set of cabins, I think, or for a facility, that they're doing it for a family reunion, and what they have is they have 50 members in their family, so each one of the 50 gets online at that, or on the phone at that moment to magnify their chance of getting it for their, you know, for their particular purpose. And I think that these are all information management issues, but it's a question of how can you, if the emphasis is going to be totally on price, how can you look at the kind of service and the fairness of that service, too?
Commissioner Bedrow.
Madam Chair, I hope I didn't imply that we are going to go to low bid on all of our professional, technical, and other technical contracts. What we did was we've issued a policy that suggests a much greater emphasis ought to be placed on price, never more than 50%, particularly in professional and technical contracts. So where those qualifications, prior experience, knowledge of the project, and citizen effectiveness, if that's one of your evaluation criteria, will outweigh price. But we do believe that there should be greater emphasis on price, and we do believe that agencies are missing great opportunities to negotiate some of these contracts once the award has been made. Just by asking, in two cases that I'm familiar with, by asking the vendor, suggesting that we didn't quite have that much money in our budget, they spontaneously reduced their prices. In one case, $700,000. So by asking and sitting down at the negotiation table, those are the kinds of things that we want to emphasize. And by all means, and this is particularly true in construction and engineering design, where I know that constituency is very concerned that we're just going to go to the low bid mentality on all of our designs, for example, that will never be the case. Qualifications and experience and citizen experience, if that's one of the criteria, will always outweigh price.
Okay. Any final comments here before we move on? Commissioner Badgerow, Commissioner Khanna?
Thank you. I'm going to remain up here with Mr. McElroy, I believe, to support him.
Great. And as he comes forward, members, if I could just kind of give you a logistics thing where we're at here. We'll have Mr. McElroy and Mr. Rhodes present, and then probably Mr. Cleary present before lunch. I'm hoping we can be done here by 12:30, and then we'll take about a 45-minute break for lunch and come back about 1:15 to finish up with Mr. Shepherd and then go into the legislative reform discussion. So we have about 50 minutes here before we'll take a lunch break. So with that, Mr. McElroy, thank you for coming today, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Dan McElroy. My title is Senior Advisor to the Governor on Innovation. And first of all, I want to thank Commissioner Badgerow and congratulate our new CIO. We want to make clear that the Governor didn't ask me to take on this role because DRIVE wasn't going well or because innovation isn't alive and kicking in state government. But rather, we made the decision that with about 14 months left in before the next election, the governor wanted to make very clear where this effort falls on his priority list. Let me just go back and tell a story. On November 3rd of 2002, which was a Sunday evening, my phone rang, and I picked it up, and it was Governor, then State Representative and Majority Leader Pawlenty. And I said, Governor, why are you calling me 2 days before an election when you should be out campaigning? And he said, well, I'm beginning to feel like the dog that chased the school bus, and I'm wondering what do I do with it if I catch it, and where are you going to be on Wednesday? And on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday of that following week after he was elected, we had a number of conversations about my leaving the legislature, selling a couple of businesses, and becoming Commissioner of Finance to address the what we thought then was about $1.5 billion deficit. It got a little bigger. And he said to me something that I will always remember. He looked me in the eye and said, Dan, we didn't get elected to run government. We got elected to change government for the better. And that has been a high priority. It was at sometimes we were not able to concentrate on it with a $4.6 billion deficit to the extent we wanted to. But Governor Plenty wanted to make the message extremely clear to state employees, to our commissioners, to everyone who's involved in state government, that leaving the enterprise of state government to be as efficient, to be as customer-oriented, and to be as effective as possible is a very high priority. And so my new job is to assist Commissioner Badgero, Gopal, and the other members of the sub-cabinet on accomplishing their mission. I'm going to do that by helping sell that effort internally and externally. Secondly, I'm going to assist in asking the question for the governor, what can we do next? These are the first phase, six business cases out of 24, and we expect to queue up additional business cases, perhaps in the next legislative session or as we move into things that we can do administratively. We'll also be asking questions kind of beyond the issues that we're driving in or addressing in Drive to Excellence. What more can an administration do to leave the nonpartisan, non-political enterprise of how we do the business of state government in as much the state of a 21st century competitor as is humanly possible. I'm also keeping some issues for the governor. He asked me to keep the policy advisor portfolio for gaming and for stadiums and for tribal relations. Those may take a little time. And then I'll continue to help with some communications issues. So I expect to have a busy next 13 or 14 months. It is fun. It has been fun to move from the bridge, from the vortex of state government to the chart room of the ship and help set direction and help work with some really great people. But in doing that, the first thing I did was go back to the library and get a copy of, and Representative Kahn may be the only person in the room who remembers this, but to a report issued in 1973 called the LEAP Report, the Loan Executive Action Plan. We then had the CORE report, we've had the Weber-Brandl report, we've had the Big Plan. And people ask me, why in the heck do we need another strategic reinvention of state government when we have done it over and over? And I ask them, well, running state government isn't an event or a one-time thing. It is a process, and it's a little like either maintaining a home or business or a garden. It takes ongoing cultivation to keep it growing successfully and to keep it headed in the right direction, keep the weeds out. But we can also learn from those previous plans, and I was struck by the letter of conveyance signed by Douglas Dayton to Governor Wendell Anderson in 1973, in which they said there are five great challenges in state government. One is that the organization is so mind-numbingly complex that no citizen can understand it, and it should be simpler. Second, there's a conflict between management and leadership. The governor gets reelected every 4 years and parachutes in a few commissioners and deputy commissioners and assistant commissioners. And we haven't been as successful as we should be in making the connection between the direction of an administration and its policy goals and its governance and the day-to-day business decisions that managers do, and we can manage better. Thirdly, the incentives of state government have been confused and maybe not as productive as they should be. If an agency comes to the legislature with a way to save $20 million on the operation of their business by doing it better, our reaction is not to say thank you and congratulations, but to grab the money and use it for whatever priority we may have. And it is difficult to motivate business teams when the result of their doing a fabulous job is they may have fewer resources with which to accomplish their mission in the future. The other two things they identified, very honestly, are things I think we have dealt with in the last 30 years. One was in 1973, we didn't have a statewide accounting system or a statewide uniform purchasing or HR system, and that's been addressed with systems like MAPS, the accounting and procurement system, and Semaphore. We also, at that time, there wasn't a central Department of Employee Relations. Human resources was done in every department of state government with the help of a benefits commission, a civil service commission, five different pension commissions. And the recommendation from the LEAP group is that we have a centralized, what has become the Department of Employee Relations, with some central responsibility for the relationship between state government and its employees. Those two things have been well dealt with. We still have the opportunity to deal with the other challenges they brought to our attention. Can we organize state government so it is more consistent with how we want our business to be done? We're going to be coming to you for some help with that in a variety of ways. I can't tell you exactly how today. Some of the projects in DRIVE have to do with organization, like the Office of Enterprise Technology being made a clearer and fairly more enterprise shared services approach, and with the reorganization of building codes. But we are re-looking at the recommendation in the CORE report that we have fewer and larger agencies, or with the experience in Virginia with what they call secretariats, organization issues may be part of what comes forward. We certainly want to look at how we manage state government. We have a couple of projects going on in various agencies to increase training for state managers. There's an emerging executive program in a couple of areas, but our management system and style can certainly get better. Then we have to ask that tough question about incentives. Are we prepared to make resources available that are consistent with good decision-making in agencies, or with risks that agencies are willing to take? And I hope the answer to that will be yes. Let me just follow up on a couple of things that I heard in the earlier testimony, and maybe I can help with some things. There are two organizations that do studies of how government's doing in the digital world. One is Representative Conray's, is the one at Brown University. Their study is on their website. I believe it actually went from 42nd to 47th, not 2nd to 47th. We are still behind Guam, but ahead of Mississippi. That is heavily dependent on e-transactions, on the ability to buy licenses online, convey transactions, buy and sell things online, and we've been relatively slow in that area. The Center for Digital Governance at Stanford, I think we are 16th or 17th, something like that, that's more aimed at e-information. Can you get budgets and committee schedules and telecasts of committee hearings, and can you find out what's going on in more of a public information basis? We do better in public information than in public transactions. I can't, I won't attempt to say why did we fall behind. It's interesting, but it's not very helpful. The question is, obviously the customers of state government like the idea of being able to transact with us in a more central location. With as many different functions of state government as we have, taking an enterprise approach toward e-transactions makes sense. I know we can do better in the future. The other issue that has been discussed is this issue of cybersecurity. I'm delighted that Gopal Khanna has taken that on. It's surfaced at the Department of Public Safety over the website for Driver and Vehicle Services. Before Gopal was hired, there was a position posted for DPS to hire its own cybersecurity person. We put a hold on that and asked Gopal to coordinate that so we take a more enterprise-wide view of it. The challenge to cybersecurity is not just on a single website or in a single department. It's probably every place that we put public opportunities up where there may be data that people can get at. There are an awful lot of entrepreneurial crooks in the e-world, and they would rather try and dig data out of a government system than do it honestly, and we're going to try and make it just as difficult for them as we can. We can learn from lots of other areas of both the private industry and other areas of government that have largely thwarted. Data gets separated, so it isn't easy to connect a driver's license number to a name because they may be in separate databases. It isn't easy to connect a phone number to a name because of how you store them. We can win that war, but it's one we have to fight on an enterprise-wide basis and not trench to trench. So that's my outlook for the next for the balance of 2005 and 2006. As Dana said, I've been on the road giving speeches to chambers of commerce and rotary clubs and county managers and city managers and the northern mayors and government finance professional association, and expect to do a lot more of that. As has been asked, the cities and counties clearly have a role. They are concerned. I too remember ISAC, which was the name of that group, the ISAAC. Jim Krautkramer, former mayor, was the manager of that. I don't know that we want to bring it back as it was, but to bring back that function in some form certainly merits some further discussion. We're in this with our partners. I should also tell you that I've been meeting with state employee unions. And I'm just delighted that the rank and file of state employees aren't uniformly excited because they wonder what does it mean to them, but if they also, I think, are convinced that for many it's an opportunity to show their professionalism, and the reception from our unions is one, basically, thanks for asking, thanks for listening to us, we want to be involved. So with that, let me say thank you for the opportunity to be here, and I'd be happy to take any questions you might have.
Questions from members? First up, Representative Khan.
Okay. thank you very much, Madam Chairman and Mr. McElroy. I guess you may be the only person who's read all of those reports, but I'm the only person sitting at the table who lived through all of those reports. So, as I was, just to kind of get some basis, one of those reports, and now I can't remember which because they all merged together, CORE and LEAP suggested the abolition of the Office of the Treasurer, which we actually did. And I'm just interested in, since I came through the legislature, how you voted on that.
It was CORE that recommended that, and I voted for it. I think it was Representative Greiling's bill, as I recall, although Representative Knobloch had one also. And I think that's maybe a longer discussion, but I think that has worked well. When the state treasurer, the office of the state treasurer, moved in more into the executive branch and into the Department of Finance, we wrote 7.5 million paper checks in 2002. One of the things that this reinvention of government will do is I suspect next year we'll write fewer than 1 million paper checks and the balance of the electronic funds transfers. Paper check costs about 60 cents and an EFT about 2 cents. And that isn't the exact purpose of the state treasurer's office, but moving it into the main body of state government got them some access to more services from Intertech, to more new thinking. It's I think the move of the state treasurer's office has been a real success.
Representative Khan.
Well, Madam Chairman and Mr. McElroy, I was a co-author of that, so I obviously agreed with that, so I'm pleased to see that. But one of the things, then, why don't we make it more attractive for people to use these electronic transfers? For example, I was pleased when the scandal came out about the problem with the public safety hackers. I was pleased that I was saved my essential cheapness because I had to renew my license or register, whichever it was, at that time. And when I saw there was an extra fee, I just said, I can just go do this by myself instead of pay this extra fee. You know, I can just fill out the paper and send in the paper check instead of doing that. So how are you going to get people like me who won't pay extra fees for something they think ought to be cheaper to use them?
Yeah. And,
Mr.
Madam Chair, that was in part how that service was paid for. Part of it was also paid for with some advertising revenue. And that's a discussion that we'll be having with the legislature as to how some of these should be funded. There are a variety of models around the country. Some have been funded with, in Pennsylvania and Maryland, they have what's called a productivity bank, where an agency like DVS could literally borrow money from the state productivity bank and repay it with savings through administrative cost reductions. I don't have a magic answer for you, but the many citizens have thought that the $2 or $3 charge was worthwhile. Others have said, cost of a postage stamp and writing a check, I'll do it the old way. Choice isn't a bad thing in a commercial environment. Some people would rather go in to their county registrar or to a local license establishment. I think we'll continue to offer choices. They probably won't be just one way to transact business with state government.
But my objection was not to offering the choice. My objection was that the financial incentives seem to be in the wrong direction for state government.
I understand. We'll provide the best incentives we can.
Okay, I have three other members with questions. First up, Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just maybe an observation you can comment on Mr. McElroy, but a few moments ago we talked about the process of keeping us on the cutting edge, and that it wasn't a destination, but it's something that we're doing all the time. We do government, if I can use that term, isn't just something we snap our fingers and government's done. It's something we have to get up every day and come down here and do, because people keep living their lives and thinking up all kinds of interesting things that we need to react to or build rules and regulations about. I think I want to just comment that cybersecurity strikes me as pretty much the same boat. We can't just buy a magic program or shoot a magic bullet and cybersecurity is accomplished and we're now secure, because the human mind and heart can be devious beyond all imagination. And every time we erect a new firewall, well, there's people out there that just look at that as a challenge and a way to get around it. So isn't security sort of a moving target that we've always got to be reacting to? And is it a fallacy or a pipe dream to believe that we're always going to be in a totally secure world, whether we're doing business on paper, at a bank teller, or over the Internet?
Mr. McElroy.
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, I think that's an excellent point. It isn't a one-time event. It's going to be something that's ongoing. Gopal Khan and I had a conversation a week or two ago in which he told me that we're probably only seeing the tip of the iceberg. It's going to get worse before it gets better. Mm-hmm. But there are also a lot of smart people working on ways to make these transactions secure. And we won't be finished, but we will... I know we'll make incremental progress, and I think we're learning a lot more about how to keep data secure.
Okay, next up is Representative Dempsey.
How long, Dan, will it take to accomplish what you've already started? What is the timeline in regard to that?
Mr. McElroy.
Madam Chair and Representative Dempsey, there is a timeline in the Drive to Excellence Transformation Roadmap, and as Commissioner Badgero said, some of the projects go out to 2010, although I think most of those are in the next phase of business cases. We're going to see a lot of progress on these various projects. We have some deliverable dates yet this calendar year and a lot of deliverable dates next year. We've already seen significant progress, for example, on the business building code consolidation and on the IT governance projects, licensing project, and probably real property will have requests for proposals for system solutions. I'll use that term, or systems anyway. The RFP should be out yet this year. On licensing, but not on real property. Real property will be early next year. If you want to know when we'll be done, the garden will always be evolving and growing, but I think you'll see major projects, major progress on these six through next year. Some of the work continues into 2007 and a little beyond. These are big changes.
Follow up, Representative Dempsey.
Yes, thanks, Madam Chair. And my question is let's just say, for example, the governor has this put into place. And let's say for some reason or whatever, the governor is not reelected or whatever. Now what? We don't have someone that's committed to what we're trying to accomplish. And I think if you were to ask the people in this committee, they'd say, oh, yes, we really need to see to it that we upgrade and that we are more efficient and we are able to cut costs and so on. If we don't have someone with the same mindset, does the legislature take the leadership, or what?
Mr. McElroy.
Madam Chair, Representative Dempsey, this project will have a certain momentum of its own because it has roots within the state employees and state IT infrastructure with middle management. There are a lot of people in state government who know that better systems are good for everybody. And so I think it will have a fair amount of natural momentum. I also have confidence that... whatever administration may be in place, I hope we'll see the wisdom of that doing things well, it shouldn't be a partisan issue. You know, my liberal friends should like making government more efficient and more effective because it makes more money available for services, has more of the dollar state spends in the front office rather than the back office. My most conservative friends should love innovation in government because it reduces the pressure on future taxes, hopefully helps control costs. These shouldn't be partisan. This should be one part of state government that is not very partisan. And so I'm confident that the combination of momentum and the fact we have an awfully strong case will mean that whatever happens in a new administration, an effort for government reform, innovation, and efficiency will continue. It may look different than it does today. That's true of everything in an executive branch or in any branch of state government after an election. It's the way the system works.
Next up, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. McElroy. I hope I'm not opening too big a can of worms here, but I have two concerns. that are, well, a couple of very hot issues right now. One is energy use, and the other is disaster management. And what I'm wondering, and maybe both of you could address this briefly, I hope, because I know we could probably have a whole session on these two topics, but how are the changes that we're making going to affect these two areas? I'm getting questions on both of these things. You know, the bird flu issue was brought up by the governor, people are wondering how prepared we are, but that's not really what I want to get into now. I really more want to get into how these changes are going to affect those two areas.
Mr. McElroy.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Liebling. Commissioner Badgerow may have other views on this, but none of our six projects are directly related to disaster management or energy consumption, although on the energy side that it is a sourcing issue. We do bid some energy issues. There are certainly people from around state government that are involved at Commerce and the Public Utilities Commission and other places. On the regulatory side of energy, it's pretty much outside the scope of what we're doing in DRI. On the disaster management issue, I'm hopeful that having fewer resources devoted to utility aspect of state government will leave more resources to have to address the program and policy areas of state government. And just for example, and it's somewhat separate from DRI, but the decision was made in 2002 to have combined facilities for the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health. And with the concern about laboratory capacity for things like bird flu, and that wasn't the beginning. SARS came before that, and the Asian avian flu before this H5S1 current virus, M1. That brought together those two departments, but with somewhat less overlapping infrastructure. They're able to put more of their resources into the work they do and less into computer centers and email facilities. They put a lot of effort into sharing and support services when they moved into those two new buildings. It's probably the change in culture rather than the change in these six projects that will have an impact about making more resources mm-hmm. available, particularly for this disaster management. Interestingly enough, and I think it's been fully discussed, the emergency management function of the Department of Public Safety in the Homeland Security area now has a full-time person from the Department of Health that participates in that to increase the communication between health and public safety. That's an example of moving across the silos of state government. It's not particularly related to these six projects.
Okay, any further questions for members?
Well,
Representative Kahn.
Again, just as part of the institutional memory of this place, I will have to point out that one of the worst state decisions that I ever saw was the decision to locate those two buildings on the Capitol complex, where essentially it was every presentation during committee had them left at Lafayette, which has much less people going back and forth. There was clearly no need for those labs to interact with state government, no need for them to be there. The putting of a lab building on this complex made no sense. And again, you know, part of my proof that this was the correct interpretation, it was one of those rare cases where it was a con-crinky agreement. So, and I understand now that the two buildings put together is that the Department of Health employees have not managed to be consolidated, that there are a whole bunch that are someplace else because the part of that building that's related to health offices isn't enough to hold all the Department of Health employees. Is that true? And wasn't the presentation was that the buildings were supposed to bring them both together?
Madam Chair, to be honest with you, I don't remember that they were all going to be in one place. I knew we would get out of 414 Delaware. And I recall that the discussion about the wisdom of having the labs here, that was done at the end of the last administration. I think at the idea was to eliminate overlap, and But as there has been some additional federally funded positions in the Department of Health. We can find out for you if they're all there. I honestly don't know.
Okay, anything further? Thank you, Mr. McElroy. We look forward to your work over the next year or two with area. Appreciate it. Commissioner Badgero. And I think we're going to have Mr. Rhodes come forward and make a brief presentation, and then we'll go into Mr. Clary's overview. Welcome, Mr. Rhodes, former chair of this committee. Welcome
back.
Thank
you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Following all these presenters reminds me of the time I had to follow Senator Wellstone and give a speech welcoming new Americans that just spoke Russian, and had to welcome them to Minnesota. So after Senator Wellstone spoke, I just taught him to say, "You betcha," and up north, and welcomed them and sat down. Just to briefly give you an idea of what's going on, there's approximately 42 people that are working on this task force to talk about the future of the board building that was in legislation. And basically the gist is that we want to talk about the availability of potential leases for the building, constraints on leasing the building, and the cost of restoring the building. That's the things that we have to report back to the legislature in January. The building, for those of you that don't know, was built in 1913 by Ford Motor Company, and they had prototypes of this building all over the country, as a matter of fact, just like Target does today. And Representative Kahn will tell you, so I will say it for her, not one of them has been torn down yet. Correct, Representative Kahn? And in case you don't know, the bricks outside have been removed from the top of the building because they were starting to fall out through decay, but they were not thrown away. They were all stored in the building. So the Department of Administration is not preempting this and tearing down this building. That was just a safeguard so nobody gets hit on the head. They actually did manufacture cars in this building, and they actually have, if you go inside of it, you will see F's on the pillars, the Ford F, their logo F, to show the historical significance of this facility. As you know, it's part of the tunnel system, and as you know, it's on a very choice piece of property in the Capitol complex. The ideas that have come forward after we heard about the history was to make it a museum for cars, a sports and health club, a restaurant, condominiums, homes, even a retirement home for legislators was brought up. This is for true. And so we are looking at all those things in conjunction with how it fits into state law as well as the Constitution, because as you know, and as Peter Sawson pointed out, when it's built with bonding money, whether it's paid for or not, has certain restrictions on the use, and that we have to take into serious consideration. We are now at the phase that we are going to be going ahead and bringing in the ideas of where do we want to go from here with the museum or retirement home or whatever it may be, and try to work out a plan to build some consensus of the members of the committee. And they are going to be able to, November 22nd at our next meeting, they are going to be able to sit down and hopefully come up to some idea of where we're going with this so we can talk about the gist of the whole thing, which is the future of the Ford building, whatever that may be. And so that's kind of where we're at. And if there's any questions, I know you're all hungry as I am, I'd be happy to take them.
Representative McMahon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Rhodes, are we, you talked about others restrictions because bonding money was involved in our recent capital investment tour of Worthington. We visited a building where I think I looked at the report. We had about $5 million of bonding money involved in the what I would call a Prairie Home debacle or whatever, and we ended up selling it for $400,000. So we certainly must have flexibility some way, somehow to deal with it. Are we considering selling this building to the private sector and let them deal with this on their own?
Madam Chair, there's a McNamara. The situation is like this. This has been brought up as the sale of the building and also moving the facility off the spot like they did with the house down in St. Paul. The issue is it has to go through a process if it is to be sold, and that has to be declared a surplus property. We have to show that we have no use for it. Then it has to be offered at market value to other local government entities, and if they aren't interested, yes, it could be then sold to the private sector. Another thought came out that we could actually make it into a condominium complex, keeping part of it for the state and then selling off the upper floors. But no dollars can be put into fixing up the upper floors before the sale of the property.
Follow-up, Representative McMurr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the bottom line, Mr. Rhodes, we are considering at least looking at the possibility of letting the private sector find a way to utilize this building?
Madam Chair, Representative McNair, that has been discussed, and there's all the options are on the table.
Okay, next up, Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair and Mr. Rhodes, I'm on the advisory committee. It's been fascinating. We had an actual historical presentation of transportation that led to the building being created, and it's pretty interesting. I learned from that we almost became the Detroit of the United States. At one point, the Twin Cities and Detroit were actually competing. We had Mack trucks and all kinds of vehicle manufacturers clustered here. It was a fascinating thing. But what I found even fascinating related to government operations and our understanding of how it works is that this building really became obsolete and vacant, not because its structure was poor, not because it hadn't gotten any upgrading, but it was actually based on state policy. And so, I mean, I think it's a good lesson for all of us on perhaps unanticipated consequences as we move forward, because the decision was made to privatize the printing operation, and there was an organization called DocuTech that used to run all the printing presses and copy machines for the state that took the entire basement of that building and a major part of the first back half of the first floor and serve a state government and published, you know, amendments and all those kinds of things. And when the decision was made that that would go out to bid contracting, then no one wanted to bid. State agencies wanted to rent basically a windowless basement with, you know, no charm, and a loading dock storage facility in the back of the building. And the Department of Administration policies were buildings had to be self-supporting. And so the cost of that space got jacked up the rent on all the other state operations within that building. And they said, whoa, wait a minute, we'd have to lay off staff, we'd have to discontinue programs, this isn't going to work. And they started looking for other space because individual operations of state government now have the authority to go off and decide they want to be somewhere else, and Department of Administration leases it. And so the bookstore moved out, other things moved out because they could find a less expensive space. The consideration whether that space would better serve the public wasn't part of that. It was all about dollars. And so I think we've ended up with a wonderful resource in terms of a beautiful historic building on the tunnel system, which is something we won't be able to create in any other place, becoming vacant, and then, of course, taking the heat out of the building causes structural stresses and those sorts of things. And so we're kind of learning. This is sort of a learning laboratory for some of us to figure out how do we create policies on state-owned property such that they're sustainable if we believe that historic preservation is a value that we ought to incorporate. The other thing that's just some interesting information for the rest of you who aren't serving on that committee that I think is something that many people don't know. I certainly didn't know it, and I certainly didn't know that it was a car manufacturing building. The other thing that I think I would like people's reactions to is an idea that I floated is to maybe we should reconsider creating a one-stop shop for access to government services, and that's one of the things that we're exploring as one of the options. I thought it was wonderful when the state bookstore was there. I wandered in and I found, gee, this is a place you can actually find interesting, useful things, whether it's state biking maps or books that you can give as gifts. You know, the DNR puts together great things on how to attract wildlife to your yard and all those sorts of things. And, you know, whether or not it'd be a place where you could renew your driver's license, whether a place you could pick up your hunting or fishing license, whether it be a place that you could, if you didn't know where in state government to go, to, you know, you're that person dreaming of that restaurant, there'd be a place that you could actually stop and they tell you who it is that's handling those 8 different licenses that you need and how to connect up to it. It could have some computer terminals for people who don't have e-access, since a lot of our agencies no longer publish reports but only have them available on the web. And so, anyhow, that's one of the ideas that's kicking around, is to create a gateway to state government. And if others have been dreaming of other needs that aren't met in state government, I know the committee would be open to it. Our obligation is to first look at public uses, because it has to be declared not
able to meet any public purpose before it can be made available to the public to the private sector. And so we're going to look at these things, and the administration's doing some research about other agencies, and we've gotten information about what they're paying in rent and whose leases are up and all those sorts of things. So, but I just thought I'd share that idea of kind of a one-stop gateway into to state government as one that I'd welcome other people's reactions to.
Madam Chair, members, just to the building goes back obviously many years ago when it was, I believe the Attorney General's office was located in there for some time, and the office was up above. The legislature actually closed down PrintCom because it was an economic issue, I think about four or five years ago, something like that. And the bookstore was basically the only thing that was in there, and it's just feasibly, it is very expensive for one small operation in that facility. And it is connected to the tunnel, which is a huge, huge thing that once it goes, it goes. So anybody that has any ideas, please let us know, and we'll continue on, and hopefully we're going to come to some conclusion on this thing.
Representative Khan.
It was interesting, though, the one private person who was at the last meeting, or one of the ones, said, of course, that connection to state government is a big disadvantage for the private sector. It means it gives us... So,
okay,
all in how you look at things.
Thank you, Mr. Rose. We'll look forward to that for next session. Appreciate it. Okay, we'd like to just switch the order here real quickly. Mr. Shepherd is going to give a presentation. Members, it's in your packet called the 2005 State Laws Relating to Government Operations. And then we'll break about 12:30 or so, come back from lunch about 1:15, and then we'll do Mr. Clary's presentation and then go into the legislative reform. So with that, Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair and members, I'll only touch on about a dozen of the things in here briefly because I think you can read what you like, and please feel free to contact me with any questions. I'm always fascinated because when I look through all the laws at the end of every year, I find a lot of things that relate to this committee that didn't go through the committee, and it's sort of an impressive variety of things, and there's a lot of things that just interest me of how they came through the legislative process. The first one, which I mentioned, is rulemaking. This was Representative Seifert's bill, was vetoed by the governor in 2004. He reintroduced something at the beginning of the 2005 session that would have required legislative approval of all rules that cost business, small businesses or small cities a certain amount of money. Interestingly, in this committee, I don't think it was amended in this way, but I think Representative Loeffler had offered an idea to, instead of having the legislature have to review all of these rules, to have give small cities and small businesses the ability to opt out of the rules instead if they met the cost threshold. Representative Seifert picked up that idea, carried it through in the state government finance bill, and that is how it was enacted. So we do have a new law now that says if the first year annual cost of a new rule is going to be over $25,000 for a small business or for a small city, that the city can opt out of it. No experience with it yet, and one thing that you all may want to consider, after the thing was enacted, I realized there's really no notice back to the legislature of cities opting out of this. So, I was going to try to collect information for this meeting and realized I'd have to call all the agencies. So you might want to think about some type of a reporting mechanism for that law. I haven't spoken with Representative Seifert. That was the major development in rulemaking. You all heard a lot of other bills that were fairly routine in either granting rulemaking authority or providing exemptions from rulemaking. On public employment, I'm just going to point out two or three things here. First of all, Representative Peterson had a bill that gave the State Board of Investment authority to create a compensation plan for its employees who aren't covered by collective bargaining agreements. That was enacted. The board is now in process of developing a plan, and it will be presenting that to a LCC, Legislative Coordinating Committee, Subcommittee on Employee Relations very soon, probably next month, that will be a new compensation plan for those employees. That eventually will need to be ratified by the full legislature, and I assume that the bill ratifying that would come back either to this committee or to state government finance. The second development in the 2005 legislature on state employees was you ratified a number of the collective bargaining agreements and compensation plans from the last biennium. ones that covered the period that ended June 30th of 2005. That was a fairly routine, non-controversial action. Since then, as you've read in the newspaper, new collective bargaining agreements have been agreed to by the Department of Employee Relations and most of the state employee unions. Most of the contracts are now settled, so you should expect to see another bill next year in which you would vote to ratify those collective bargaining agreements. That will be presented, again, likely to this committee or state government finance. And if you have any questions about any of the details of the contracts or the details of any of these bills, I'll be around after noon, too, if you want to ask questions about those. The last thing in the state employment area, the two last things were both that I'm going to mention and highlight here, were both initiatives of Representative Earhart. The first, you may recall, he had a bill to repeal the local government salary cap. That did not occur, but it was compromised. The cap, which was formerly 95% of the governor's salary, was increased to 110% of the governor's salary. So now the local government salary cap, instead of being approximately $114,000, is approximately $132,000. And also, and significantly for local governments, that amount is indexed in law to inflation every year, so it'll be increasing every January. So that was enacted fairly late in the session. Finally, you might recall Representative Earhart had a bill that would make the state radio communications operators essential employees, put them in their own bargaining unit, and provide that they cannot strike. That was enacted. That has happened. They've settled the first contract as part of their new bargaining unit, and you'll be, I think it was not controversial in its first implementation anyway. There were not issues of them wanting to strike this time around. So that's in place. I'm just going to touch on a couple of things relating to the Department of Administration that weren't mentioned earlier. You all gave the department some new methods for doing state construction projects, a bill that went through this committee. It was Representative Beard's bill, and this authorized design build, construction manager at risk, and job order contracting. You may remember it was a fairly lengthy bill, and it was enacted pretty much the way that it was went through this committee. There was some discussion earlier of state energy purchasing, and there were two bills that were enacted that didn't go through this committee, but that were actually passed as part of the Jobs and Economic Development Finance bill in the end that touch on state energy use. The first one requires the Department of Administration to identify opportunities for demonstrating the use of hydrogen fuel cells in the state vehicle fleet. And that was in an energy bill that I might have gone through Representative Westrom's committee at some point. It eventually wound up in an omnibus bill. Second, there was a requirement that the state fleet reduce the use of gasoline by on-road vehicles owned by state departments. There are targets of 25% reduction by 2010, 50% by 2015, and similar reductions for the use of petroleum-based diesel fuel. And so that's something the Department of Administration will be implementing as part of its responsibility for the state vehicle fleet. Also, the Representative Kahn had a bill to provide a memorial in the Capitol for Koya Knutson. That was enacted as a requirement that the commissioner would establish a memorial in the Capitol building honoring Koya Knutson. So an interesting provision of the tax bill, which I learned about only after reading the laws at the end of the session, was a requirement that executive and legislative agencies cancel contracts for goods or services upon notification that a vendor is not registering to collect sales and use tax. This is sort of an interesting legal issue with companies like computer companies that don't have facilities in the state but that are selling goods to state citizens over the internet, a number of the major computer manufacturers. This is now requiring them, even though they might not otherwise be constitutionally required to collect sales tax for Minnesota, it's saying that if you want to do business with the state, then you have to collect the sales tax from our residents. I don't know a lot about this. It was a, sort of a major item of discussion in the tax world, and it was enacted this year. I'll just touch on a couple of state government organization issues. You've already heard about the Office of Technology being created. That was probably the biggest thing that happened.
Excuse me, Mr. Shepard, I have a question from Representative Hahn.
Before we you leave this page, I'm interested in the janitorial services for the HHS building. And I know that that was, and I know that that was eventually awarded to the internal group that bid for it. And I do know that a supported work vendor bid for it too, and they were, and they did not get it. And one of the arguments, and one of the reasons, even though one of the reasons, they said, well, they weren't the lowest bidder. But I understand that the bidder who got it wasn't the lowest bidder either. So I'm interested in knowing, you know, that seemed to be a more restrictive requirement, and I'd also like, I guess, the financial comparison of what the bid was that was refused and what the bid was that got it.
I don't see anybody here from admin. I don't know, Mr. Shepard, if you can follow up with that.
Sure, Madam Chair, I will follow up with the department on that. I don't have
and I think maybe the that maybe the need, you see, it's as I read this summary language, it says that they submit a bid equal or less than the bid submitted by other vendors, but this thing is that they don't, it doesn't say they have to have a bid equal or less than the one that gets it. It looks as if you could just totally eliminate them and then choose a vendor that may not have been the low bid vendor anyway. So, and you know, I'm not, I really don't know enough, I don't know enough about it to say whether this group should have been chosen or not. I do note that when a complaint was made, they said, well, they were eliminated because they weren't the lowest bid vendor. So.
Okay, we'll have Mr. Shepard do some follow-up. Okay,
we'll check
further things here. What are we, page 6, 7?
Madam Chair, I guess I'd turn to page 7 briefly and just note that you probably recall the committee heard a large number of bills that were creating or extending advisory groups. Many of these did pass, and I will do a, I'm going to do a comprehensive report on all the state advisory groups in the next month or two, and so I'll give you information on the status of all those. I won't go into the pension bill at all, other than just to note city and county concerns. Your cities and counties are now going to be paying a higher contribution to the Public Employees Retirement Association, PARA. That was a major item of discussion in the Pension Commission, and everyone on both the employer side and the pension administration side agreed that higher contributions were needed. And pretty much most of the employers signed off on this. Most of the unions, with one notable exception, also signed off on this. So that will be phased in. The new rates are on the table at the bottom of page 7. I'm just going to skip to what I refer to as other governmental operations issues, which is pretty much totally miscellaneous. You'll recall Representative Mark Olson had a bill in this committee and other committees that would have given a process under which local governments seeking to opt out of state mandates would have had some priority status at the legislature. That was not enacted, but in the state government finance bill, there was a section that allows local units of government to file resolutions with the state auditor objecting to state mandates and requiring the auditor to catalog those on her website. I checked the website a few days ago, and I haven't seen anything on that yet. But there may be something. Also, on the state auditor, there was a process under which the auditor, local governments can now seek waivers from rules or procedural laws from the state auditor. This is similar to something that was in effect with a former group called the Board of Government Innovation and Cooperation. That is enacted. The state auditor has on her website some instructions and descriptions. If any of your local governments are interested in pursuing that, they can learn more on her website. A couple of things on the Attorney General. One is that there's a new requirement that when the Attorney General is hiring outside legal counsel for services anticipated to exceed over $1 million, they will have to present that request to the Legislative Advisory Commission 20 days before they sign the contract. The commission won't have approval or veto power. It's more or less just a notice requirement, and they could give advice. The other controversy, you may remember the Attorney General here appearing with Representative Wilken, who had a proposal relating to deposit of state litigation proceeds when the state settles a lawsuit against a private party. The law currently requires that those proceeds be deposited in the state general fund. The Attorney General believed that was prevented them from settling some lawsuits with corporations that might prefer to make a charitable donation. And Representative Wilkin strongly held the point of view that this is state money. It should go in the state general fund. And that law was coming up for sunset. That issue was settled this year by providing basically an exemption of $750,000. So if the settlement is under $750,000, the amount does not have to be deposited in the general fund. The Attorney General could settle the case, and the corporation or whoever the defendant was could make a contribution to a charity as part of the settlement. And then the sunset of the law is repealed, so that's now permanent. I think what will be a very significant development that I think you'll hear about probably from some of your units of local government this year has to do with public websites. For the first time, you enacted a law that prescribed what kind of information can be and can't be on public websites. And you stated a general purpose, that the purpose of these websites is to provide information about duties and jurisdiction of public agencies and to facilitate access to public services. Some kinds of information that are prohibited are pictures that tend to attribute the website to an individual instead of a public office, and links to any blogs or sites maintained by candidates, political committees, political parties, or party units. And some of the nuances of this I've been hearing things about. I've gotten calls from public libraries that used to maintain links to some of these kind of things that are wondering, it's now prohibited. And I think this is something that everybody, the legislature and the State Government Finance Conference Committee recognized they probably didn't have all the answers to this, and so the effective date for local government was delayed until 2006, July 1st. So you may be hearing things about that, perhaps some of you have already. Madam Chair, I am going to conclude with that. So that everybody can get off to lunch. If people have questions, I'll stick around here, or I'll be around this afternoon, or call me anytime.
Great. Appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Shepherd. So, members, just a couple announcements here before we recess for lunch. You have blue forms in your packet. If you want to fill those out now, if you're going today and tomorrow, fill it out for both days, and we'll take care of that. If you want to check in with Mr. Nesky as far as information for tomorrow with your Social Security number, and he's also collecting $4.50 for lunch tomorrow if you're going to be out at Camp Ripley with us. And so when we come back at 1:15, we'll have Mr. Clary's presentation about the information in your packet here with military and veterans enactments, and there'll be more detail on that tomorrow when we're at Camp Ripley. And then we'll conclude by probably 2:15, 2:30 today discussing this legislative reform. So with that, members, we are in recess. So 1:15.
I'm going home.
Okay. Okay. We're going to come back from recess here, Governmental Operations and Veterans Affairs, today after lunch on November 8th. And first up, members, we'll have Jim Clary from House Research give us an overview of some of the information from this last legislative session relating to military and veterans affairs. And then we'll go into a discussion about legislative reform, kind of based on the yellow sheet that we'll be going through. So we're hoping to complete here within the next hour, so right around 2:30. So with that, Mr. Clary, welcome. Thank you for your presentation, and please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, I'm Jim Clary from House Research. May I ask, is this loud enough? The microphone's working well? Okay. Good. Well, Madam Chair and members, as you know, last year was a really big year with regard to veterans and military affairs. The biggest year, in fact, legislatively, and otherwise, since I started working this area in about 1990. And next year looks like it'll be another big year. There's still a lot of things to do. In a way, some of the things we've done have been the easier things to do, fixing a lot of glitches in current laws, for example. sometimes it's real clear there's a glitch and it has to be fixed. Other things, more policy things, are going to be harder for you to decide on because the answers aren't quite so clear. Let me just put that in perspective, if I may. Some of you probably remember Gary Bladel, Chief Warrant Officer 5, Gary Bladel, who used to come over here from Department of Military Affairs and testify to this committee. He was a real dynamite sort of character, and he was always in the thick of everything. And a few months ago, I mentioned Representative Seibert's bill that fixed the National Guard time frame for the National Guard tuition reimbursement program, maybe one of the most significant things that you all did last year. And I said, Gary, you and I sat here that whole weekend before that hearing and redrafted this legislation. I said, agonized over everything. Why didn't we think that National Guard could be called to active duty? And he said, Jim, I'll tell you why. 29 and a half years in the National Guard, and I never did one day of active duty.
Wow.
So he's not a veteran. 29 and a half years, not a veteran. And he was in the thick of everything. He said, neither General Andreotti, 19 years in the National Guard. He did not do one day of active duty. He wasn't a veteran. He still isn't. You know, that's not a criticism. That's just the way the world was back then. And we didn't think of it. So you can point the finger if somebody blames you for not having thought of this. It's just life. We just couldn't imagine a world that we now have. We should have, you know, it's always a no-brainer in that respect, but we couldn't because it didn't exist before then. Members, I'd like to call your attention to this information brief, this House Research Information Brief, Military and Veterans Enactments from 2005. We tried to round up everything you did, and it was quite a job because you did so much. And with veterans bills, you don't have a single omnibus. Some of it goes into the state government finance bill. A lot of it passes separately. And so this pretty much catches everything. Feel free to use it in any of your presentation. Feel free to copy it and hand it out. A number of members already have, and they've really found it helpful. And as I go through it today, and by the way, you can get it either online or electronic copy or paper copies from us. We'll make paper copies as well. But as I go through it today to prepare this task, it occurred to me that a summary listing might be better for speaking from. And so I prepared this summary list. The summary listing is not real polished, but I put that in your packet as well. And that's what I'll be speaking from right here. In addition, there's a hunting and fishing little short subject. We're trying to prepare information like that. Maybe I'll have a chance to mention it later. On the various areas of law, we try to boil it down to 2 pages. And the reason I use this one as an example is because it's probably the least likely one any of us would ever think of as being an area in which there's a fair amount of veterans in military law, but there is. And the thing that triggered this is I teach firearm safety sometimes. This year it was the 12-year-olds. And I got a call from an Iraq War veteran who wanted to know if he could get into my class. And I said, gee, you know, that'd be so humiliating for you. You could teach me so much. You shouldn't have to go through that hoop. And then we searched the laws and realized he didn't need to go through that hoop, at least not in that way. So I thought we'll put that up online too. And we'll try to link that with Veterans Affairs. It's just one more of the things that they'll be linking to this kind of information. So, well, today I'd like to very briefly recap some of your 2005 enactments with an eye toward mentioning things that you might want to consider in 2006. And I've tried to screen all of these thoughts with regard to how I heard them. It's kind of hard to reconstruct that sometimes, but I think I've heard most of these things 2 or 3 different ways. They're kind of ideas that are out in the public domain, and a lot of them haven't taken shape yet, but I'm sure many of them will. But one of the things you did last year, and I like to remind people of this when they say the legislature didn't finish its work, I like to remind them that not only did you finish your work, you finished it several times over. You try to get agreement because we're so evenly split, that's hard to do. But one of the extra things you did was the bonding bill from 2004. You passed that in 2005. And that included a few things like the World War II Veterans Memorial, pre-design work for a new veterans home to be built in Wilmer, it's not clear to me whether that new veterans home is coming back in this year's bonding bill or a later one. And, of course, asset preservation at all the 60-plus armories and state veterans homes. That's always an expense that's out there with these old buildings. Turning to other tax things, you enacted a new Minnesota income tax deduction for certain in-state earnings, military pay. So all military pay that's earned in-state for flood and disaster relief, missing persons, federally funded state active service, like airport security duty following 9/11, all of that would be tax deductible. Drill pay is not yet tax deductible. Drill pay is still taxed. In addition, we conform with federal law making all out-of-state military pay by Minnesotan residents tax deductible as well. And that's conforming with federal law, but it goes a little farther than we used to, and it's cleaner for the soldiers. I should mention that under federal tax law, the military death gratuity, this has come up. I hope it doesn't come up again, but it could. Military death gratuity has been significantly increased from a shameful $6,000 half taxable before 9/11 to $12,000, and it looks like they have increased it. The feds have increased it to $100,000 temporarily, and the Defense Authorization Bill is bogged down in Congress throughout the summer, so it's not real clear to me if this is made permanent yet, but that's the intention. And there's a debate about how broad to make it, but I think it's drifting in the direction of making it very broad for anybody who dies in federal active service. In addition, service members' group life insurance has been increased from about $100,000 to $250,000 over the years to $400,000 now. And again, that's temporary, but it looks like it will be made permanent. So a soldier's survivors now would be much better cared for than even just a year and a half ago. And there's some discussion of whether Minnesota should do anything about that issue. But I think that the discussion generally goes back to saying, well, the feds really ought to be providing, and we'll provide if we have to. But to make it more equitable, the federal government should be providing for survivors of persons killed in military. But that didn't used to be the case. And it may not be the case in the future if they don't make it permanent. So there are other tax proposals that could arise. Representative Connie Ruth last year had a bill that would exempt drill pay. The bill was drafted pretty late in session and didn't really receive a hearing last year. That's something that would mean a lot to especially low-ranking soldiers. It could make a $500-$600 difference per year in their tax burdens. There's a proposal to exempt military retirement pay coming from older vets. There's a general thought about providing property tax relief to disabled veterans, maybe 100% disabled service connected veterans, or a broader group. Some states do that. There's a thought about providing, this is a very central policy issue, and that involves whether or not to provide tax incentives to businesses that hire National Guard reserves and veterans to make it a much more job-friendly state. There are counter thoughts from some that we should provide a lot of counseling money and so on, and that's a worthy thing too, where it's needed. But I tell you, as a veteran myself who experienced the transition, it's a lot better to have, I think, a job to keep you busy and a few bucks in your pocket and some hope for the future than to be sitting around agonizing over what you might have seen or customer experience. Turning to policy enactments, in 2005, we talked about increasing the time frame for that tuition reimbursement program, and we also talked about earlier about the federal government needing to do that for the GI Bill, and ways that perhaps you could weigh in on that issue. We extended higher education protections to veterans with service-connected disabilities. That was a Severson bill. Also ensured that students did not lose scholarship eligibility when being ordered to active duty. So if they have to pull out during a semester, they don't lose that semester's eligibility for their grants, for example, scholarships. That had been happening up until the time you enacted that legislation. Clarified the pay differential program for state employees so that they don't need to spend hours and hours calculating each and every payday when they're sitting over in Iraq and trying to do that long distance with their spouses back here. In that process, we learned that there's a real need for protecting spouses' jobs while soldiers are gone. Now, federal USARA law protects the job of the soldier itself, the civilian job, and actually the civilian job including public sector jobs. When that soldier comes back, these federal protections require that they get the job back with any growth that would have occurred in that job. And another state law applying to public sector jobs assures that they also get their vacation and sick time leave that they would have accrued during that period while they were gone. But that just applies to public jobs. Well, USARA law, as I mentioned, protects soldiers' civilian jobs, but their spouses' jobs are not protected. Now, when a soldier comes back, if they're a reservist or National Guard, they burn up their military leave before getting off active duty, and they earn a month a year. So usually when they come back, they have about 3 or 4 weeks vacation to burn up, and so they stay on active duty for 3 or 4 weeks, and they get paid for that. Of course, it's taxable once they're back. But after that, their military pay drops way back down to just the monthly rate, the monthly drill rate. Now, it's real crucial at that point that they either have a job waiting, and about half don't. These are young people in transitional jobs, many of them, when they go, and don't have a job waiting when they get back. So it's real crucial that their spouse, if they're married, would have a job. You can make a good argument that those jobs need to be protected as well, and that they need to have flexible time to take care of the kids, for example, when the soldier's off the war, or to see the soldier off, to welcome him back, to spend time with him while he's on leave, him or her. We heard from some of these wives during that testimony that it was very difficult for them to even spend time with their soldiers when they came home from the war. At that time, and those were state employees, by the way, also,
yeah,
their husbands and they themselves. Part of the issue is the union. If the legislature were to mandate that they have flex time if their soldier is gone, it would actually protect the employer from having to provide it to all their employees. The employer could say, well, we have to give it. He could tell the union, well, we have to give it to the soldiers' spouses, much as we don't like that we have to. But we can't give it to you because you're not in that same situation. So in a way, it could make it possible and provide some protection for the employers, even though it might seem like a burden on them. Okay. One of the other things you did was repeal the language that prohibited retired military personnel from receiving veterans benefits in public hiring. So now retired military personnel can get veterans benefits. Just the same as somebody who's not retired, any other veteran. The problem is that veterans' preference in public hiring really doesn't amount to anything anyway. It used to back when tests were scored, multiple choice tests, for example, and they were scored in an objective manner. But currently, almost all jobs in the public sector are subjectively scored. So if an employer likes a candidate, that candidate will get 100. If the employer really doesn't like a candidate, that candidate will get a 50. Well, adding on 5 points of veterans preference is not going to make a difference in that employer's decision. And if it did, that candidate would only get a 45, if you understand what I mean. So veterans preference is kind of a sham anyway, in a sense. It no longer does what it may have been intended to do many years ago. One of the things you did was protect the homeowner's property insurance rights while the soldier's away. So the insurance company can no longer drop him for not having for having an unoccupied house, for example, can no longer drop that soldier homeowner's insurance. So it can no longer drop him for renting out that house or charge him more or cut back on coverage given your enactment last year. Prior to that, of course, they could. There may be another need with regard to housing. We heard a case of a couple of disabled veterans who were evicted. One was homeless, and the landlady simply didn't like them. It was a tenancy at will kind of lease, month to month. Landlady didn't like him, and when the state employee, whose job it is to protect veterans like that, talked to the landlady, she too got evicted. They happened to both be in the same apartment house. Well, they got the case solved by bringing in legal defense, but it was a very touchy situation. The landlady in that case did not offer any reason for the eviction, simply a capricious sort of thing. And one could, I suppose, prohibit for disabled veterans, service-connected disabled veterans, capricious terminations of tenancy at will type leases. We also enacted several motor vehicle license plate provisions, and ironically, and these plates can be a nice honor for a veteran coming back. They'll be out in December. You'll start seeing some of them on the road. But ironically, if that veteran gets called up again and doesn't keep the vehicle, or keep the vehicle registered even, might keep the vehicle, but unless he keeps the vehicle registered, that veteran would lose those license plates. They might be assigned to somebody else. And sometimes the plate has some significance. So the legislature, if you wanted, could make a small amendment to license plate law, allowing that veteran to keep the plate while off to war. Disabled Veterans Rest Camp, you protected the Disabled Veterans Rest Camp on Big Marine Lake in Washington County. As I recall, the county park was about to appropriate the land, condemn the land. And so you protected it, but in the process you found out that rest camp had really kind of become a private enclave for a few folks, some of whom weren't even disabled veterans, and some of whom weren't even veterans. And they would rent it every summer for a nominal fee, have their own dock, and so on. I'm sure that's not what the legislature intended when it created these rest camps. I know some disabled veterans who've never heard of these rest camps. To be honest with you, this is the first year I've heard of them. So that says something, too, about what a low profile they have. There might be, I suspect we'll all be sensitized for a while about this, but as the years wear on and people change jobs and so on, retire, it could be that situation will happen again. As far as I know, there are two rest camps in the state. The other one is pretty far north. The third one was in Lake Minnetonka, and now that fell into that same kind of situation. Nobody knew about it except a handful of people who used it as their own private camping space. That one has now been sold, and the money is returned to the VA and the VFW and the department to decide how to use that on behalf of veterans. But one could simply mandate that the Department of Veterans Affairs provide some oversight, visit them at least once a year or whatever, and report back to this committee. I think something as simple as that wouldn't cost anything, and yet it would kind of make somebody responsible for it. One of the things that you did was to direct the governor to encourage veterans' employment, and that really did that in a very small way by declaring the month of May Hire a Veterans Month, and asking the governor to make a proclamation. That was a start, but it just scratches the surface. I don't know how many people actually listen to those proclamations, for example. So that was a start, and it signaled a nice thing, but it just scratches the surface. And I think you can make an argument, as I touched on before, about how important jobs are for veterans. And one of the things that some veterans that Representative Severson was working with discussed and we helped them with was this recommendation for an executive order. The governor could make such an order through his departments and so on, and ask them to examine their own policies affecting jobs and impediments. It's not clear to me if they caught his ear on that, but the legislature could enact the policy statement, for example, kind of speaking to the same issue, and that could be burned into statute. It would be there long after any of us are here, and hopefully, if you choose to do that, would hopefully keep that issue out there and
Mr. Clark,
might enable some other legislator downstream to more easily pass some legislation that considered.
Mr. Cleary, I have a question on this end. So this recommendation for an executive order, so is this just a draft, or is this actually in place, or what was the timing of this?
This was a draft. I believe the Commission of Deed was targeted to present this to the governor, and I understand that he didn't quite get the governor's ear on it.
Okay.
There was some personnel change there and so on.
Sure. So
might,
it can
might
follow through potentially. Yeah, potentially next year we could follow through on this more.
Yeah, it was something they wanted to do, and we helped them kind of get the issue through and brainstorm it some.
Great, thanks. Was there anything further?
I wanted to mention another issue, another really important issue that's sort of become clear over the last couple of years, and that is soldiers and veterans need far more access to good information about all of these laws that you're passing and all the laws that are existing. You know, it's one thing to summarize a law change, but it's another thing to summarize, like, the tuition reimbursement program itself in a way that soldiers can understand long distance. Now, the best way to understand this, I think, is to remember that military is a very hierarchical organization, and over the years they would pass, and they still do, they're still inclined to pass word down from the top. In the Marine Corps we used to say in the beginning was the word, and the word was changed. and the Marines would rarely get the word, but we got the word all the time, it was always different. But at any rate, pardon me? Just a proverb. Just a proverb.
It's our language.
Kernel of truth. Well, I tell you, these young soldiers today are so remarkable, and any of you have kids, no, they're all remarkable in that if they want to know something, they get on the web and they'll come back a minute later and say, this is where you do such and such, or this is what movie's playing, or this is the information you need, or here's a satellite photo of a hunting area. You know, and remember this clump of trees? It's just amazing what these kids can do. And in fact, just to give you an example, one night in the middle of the night, whenever my son would ding-dong or ring the doorbell from a rack on our computer, we'd fly out of bed and we'd go chat with him a few seconds before the line would go down. You know, it's just a precious moment. And I remember one night he came on and he said, "Dad, when was that bonus program passed?" I said, "Gee, you know, I know it took forever. It took a very long time because you have to wait a while till the war is over." This is the 1991 Persian Gulf War he was talking about, which was just an eye blink, right? 3 months long, max, real short. So the soldiers went off, and before we knew it, they were home, and it was a done deal. And still, it took about until 1998 until those bonuses were paid. You know, there needed to be a constitutional amendment, and there needed to be a program. So I said, "Gee, I don't know. It took forever. Why?" He said, "Well, Sergeant so-and-so said it was paid right away." You could tell Pat's feelings were a little ruffled. I said, "No, I think it was longer." He said, "Just a minute. then he was gone 2 or 3 minutes. He came back on. He said, "Here, I just found this information brief about the bonus, and it was written in 1996, House Research." Wow. You know, I was thinking, well, I wrote that, and I didn't know. It kind of pulled my head, so I didn't tell him who wrote it. But, "Oh, I see your name on it, Dad." I said, "Well, I know it was after that." He said, "It had to be after that." So I said, "Yeah, it would be." "Well, what committee funded it?" I said, "Well, that'd be the state government finance bill." "Just a minute." He was gone about 3 minutes. And then he looked in the 96, the 97, the 98 on the House Research computer at the state government finance bill, Mark's summaries, and he pulled up the summary. He said, "Here, it was funded in 1997. I said, "Well, yeah." And he said, "Let me check the language." He went out and he checked the bill. And he came back and he said, "I see the bill said such and such." You know, I said, "Well, thanks a lot, Pat." "Yeah, right. That's right. Yeah." But I didn't remember it at all. But
maybe you could get a job here.
But no. Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing, you know, and all these kids are like that. I see it in a lot of others. They look online. So here's my point. We can sit here in Minnesota and hope that these law changes get down to the soldiers, and some of them will, and a lot of them won't, from these kinds of documents, right? But if the information's online, and soldiers can come into the state of Minnesota, like they can in Wisconsin, they sit on Veterans Wisconsin, wham, they're into the centralized veterans website, and they can say, "Nursing certification," and they're out to the nursing website just like that, or they can click on nursing certification and get that information, or electrical licensing, get that, or tuition reimbursement, they've got it. So we really need a website like this, and I know, fortunately, I have good news report. Representative Severson sent word over to Veterans Affairs, and Clark reported to me yesterday that he's moving on that. I don't know if he reported that this morning, but they're moving and they're committed to doing it. And as it gains momentum, I think it can be done in a real nice way where all the agencies could link to his site. He could link to all of theirs. It wouldn't take an extra employee. He's already got an employee working on this. But all of us who write these kinds of things or short subjects on hunting and veterans preference and everything else can put that up on our website, and he can link. And that soldier wouldn't know where this information is, but the soldier would just know that it's very easy to find that website and to find that information. And they can do it in the middle of the night from Iraq. They can do it from down the street, and their families can do it. And the families really need that same. It can't be in an intranet available only to soldiers, for example. Now, let me give an example of how badly they need this. You might remember one of the women that from the prison who testified on that legislation last year that was enacted clarifying the pay differential program, one that had trouble getting time off to come down and testify. But she pointed out her husband is an E7 and just re-enlisted for another 4 years, which would take him out to 20 years. But he missed getting the $15,000 re-enlistment bonus because he got bad information about having to wait till he gets to Iraq to do that. Now, he was in the middle, you know, training day and night out in North Carolina, training his own troops and so on, and he's high enough level, he probably should have had the information to pass down, but even he himself didn't have it. So he waited till he got to Iraq. That pushed him past 16 years, and under DOD rules, you don't get the re-enlistment bonus if you're past 16 years. So that family went without that $15,000 re-enlistment bonus. I know of three other soldiers in my son's unit, my son was one of them, who didn't know about a $3,500 federal tuition assistance grant, a college grant, that was brand new. And so they went a year before they found out about it. He and two other friends, they were all attending a private school, and for private schools with high tuition, they would give them this little extra $3,500 kicker. Well, that's a pretty significant tax-free kicker. Those three soldiers didn't know about it. When they found out a year later, they went in and said, "You know, Staff Sergeant, why didn't you tell us about this? You know, or is that true?" He said, "Yeah, that's true. But why didn't you tell us? Well, I didn't know you were going to private colleges." Well, if they had access to that kind of information online, you can be sure they would have found it online. Now, that right there is 369, $10,500 plus $15,000, that's $25,500 in those four little examples that soldiers didn't get, but also that Minnesota's economy didn't get. Mm-hmm. And how often does that play out? So this really needs to be made available to them. It's a lot of work to draft this kind of information and put it up on the web. But a lot of times it's just an extra step after responding to one of your questions, for example. Given a little extra half day or so to polish it up and put it up. And it's good to see Veterans Affairs moving on that now.
Okay, we have a question from Member Representative Ruth Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Clary, on the Veterans Subcommittee that we were working on this past legislative session, there was a great deal of interest in making an easier bridge from medical work in the military to a nursing degree and nursing job in Minnesota. Pinsky was quite interested in that. Has there been any forward motion in that very worthwhile goal?
Mr. Clary?
There's been some talk about it. Again, with a legislator and a group of veterans, brought in John Ostrom, for example, the chancellor's assistant, who understood the issue and talked about that issue and essentially promised to move on it informally. And yet there's no sense that that's happening. Maybe Representative Severson knows more.
Representative Severson.
Madam Chair and Mr. Clary. The issue on that was being taken over by Minsky, and there was Deed was involved in that as well as Mr. Cornemone has been working with the licensure board on that, and they've been working kind of a hand-in-hand process. So we expect to get a report back on that, if not in December, probably at the beginning of the session. Thanks for the question.
Mr. Clary, I really appreciate the information. I'm looking at the time, and we want to get to at least one other segment of the meeting here, and I know that we'll be doing some additional information tomorrow and encourage members to individually follow up with you as well as on this issue. So thank you very much. And now, members, I'd like to move to the part of the agenda for number six there, the legislative reform discussion. I'm going to turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Severson, and Representative Loeffler and I are going to go to the table up front here to talk about things that are on the yellow sheet. So if you want to pull that up.
Adjourn. All those in favor? Chair Tingleton, Representative Loeffler, welcome to the committee on the front end here. I'd just like to say a quick word to Mr. Clary and thank him for all of his hard work for the Veterans Department. He has definitely been the impetus behind this whole thing. And I would just ask you to let's try and keep the discussion to a minimum. I think we got some out-state people who need to get on the road before the roads turn into a concrete auto. And so if we could, we'll try and get as much as we can in a short amount of time. And Chair Tingstad, would you go ahead, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I can see that the chairs here aren't as comfortable as they're up there. Maybe there's a reason for that. Your yellow sheet in front of you, I'd like to thank Representative Loeffler for working together with me on this issue, and it was originally her idea, too, to put some things together. At the end of the special session last summer, you may have remembered an email that went out to actually all members and staff in the House looking for some suggestions, and for a while I had a suggestion envelope on my office door, and I think Representative Loeffler was similar. We got things through email or through written form. And what you see in front of you today is a compilation of information from Democrat, Republican, House members and House staff. And we just sort of sorted them. There were some duplicates, obviously, from what was submitted. We didn't really make any judgments on what was submitted. You're just basically seeing everything. I'm sure you're going to disagree with some of the things on there, but we felt that it was important to bring all ideas forward. And we're hoping that this will be a basis from which we can
look at some changes over the next legislative session. I know there's some outside groups that are looking at some things. We felt that it was important to have the legislature doing some things internally as well. And I know there's going to be a training session in February that's coordinated between our national organization, the NCSL, and the Humphrey Institute. And they'll be looking at some of these ideas as well for kind of the next step for the legislature, completing our work on time, getting beyond the bickering that we've been known for. I think it's just really important that we individually take hold of some of these ideas. So I think it would be good to have Representative Loeffler talk about how this came to being and maybe the next step with the survey that we're planning on the Internet.
Representative Loeffler, please proceed.
Mr. Chair and members. Actually, I mean, I always feel that you have to capture good ideas at the time, because if you're like me, you sometimes have brainstorms and you think, wow, that's a great idea. And if you don't write it down and, you know, you don't follow it up on it right away, it's lost. And I just felt like there were so many of us who were engaged in discussions as we worked towards special sessions and ultimately endured the long special session, that there were a lot of good ideas that were starting to circulate in small and formal conversations and other ways that we needed to capture, so that when we came back together a little more calmly, not at the frustration point that we were at perhaps in July, that we could have a chance to evaluate our work and figure out ways to be more effective and efficient. And it's not just in reaction to the special session and what happened this particular year. I think at any point in time you can have personalities that clash that can to make the process difficult to deal with. But it was, as any organization, you have long-standing traditions, and sometimes you need to just stop once in a while and look at those traditions and ways of being and seeing if they still make sense, or if we ought to update them, look at more efficient ways, use technology different, whatever. And so I was really impressed with how many ideas came and how many duplicates there were. It was clear to me that there's some commonality, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, or you're a staff person observing the process from a different perspective, that many similar things came about. We made the commitment when we sent out the emails securing or soliciting these ideas that we would allow all House members to have input into this process. And the next stage will be that we will actually be sending out the list using a internet survey technology to allow all 134 members of the House to rate these. And we're looking at a pretty simple sort of process. One would be to say, you know, definitely consider it, should be considered, opposed, and the last category will be don't understand or neutral. Because there's some things that, for example, some members I know of our caucus have never served on a budget committee because of the way the committees were structured this year and may not feel like they understand enough some of the technical budget provisions, and other people may have really great knowledge of the budget process but not know some of the other, or haven't thought through some of the other issues that have been brought forward. And so we're hoping to do that yet this fall, let everyone have a chance to more formally weigh into prioritizing the list in front of you. And with that, I will just, I think we can open it to committee discussion unless you have something else, Kathy.
Mr. Chair and members, you know, I'm cognizant of the time here, and I had hoped that we'd have more like 45 minutes or so to discuss this, but I know people want to get on the road. You know, I don't think we'll bother reading through it here. You can see it in front of you yourself, but, you know, I think just even the topic headlines there for strengthening the interaction, changing the structure, looking at how our policy process is set up, or the time frames, things that might go to referendum, things that lessen our partisan divides. You know, these are all things that have sort of been bantered about individually through the years, and I think it's nice to get everything kind of on one page so we can work from that. Hoping to, you know, get this survey information out here soon so we can get some kind of a rating system and prioritize, but, you know, cognizant that any individual member can introduce any bill at any time, and, you know, many of these bills would come through our government operations committee here. So I think it just gives us a good basis from which to work. And I'm planning on meeting with some of the folks in the agencies and the governor's staff and see if we can get some buy-in on some of these issues, so that I think we can really make a nice statement about legislators working internally to help correct some of the situations that we were all very frustrated with over the last year or so.
open up for questions.
Representative Peterson.
One of the things I did learn as a newbie this year is this is a two-horse wagon.
Yes.
And have you got any buy-in from the Senate? I mean, it's fine for the legislature to talk about it, but if you don't get buy-in from the Senate, mm-hmm. this wagon doesn't move.
Well, and good point, Representative Peterson. You know, I think a big part of the meeting in February at the Humphrey Institute is kind of based on getting the House and Senate together. You know, certainly this was something that was put together by the House originally, and I'm sure, you know, each of us will be meeting with members of the Senate and, you know, encourage people in this committee and others individually to do that as well. You know, at some point with the bills that might come out of this here, you know, we'll be talking to leadership and hopefully getting some buy-in, you know, through Senate authors and Senate leadership. But I totally agree that this is definitely a two-horse place, or actually a three-horse place with the governor's office as well.
That's so. A wagon.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks.
Follow-up, Representative Peterson, anything?
Well, I'm thinking even before you go into February, you know, if you could begin to get the Senate, somebody over there starting to discuss of like mind, so they started having some buy-in that would affirm these conversations, it would be huge.
Mr. Chair and Representative Peterson, there has been discussion with people in the Senate. They didn't use the same formal process that we did, but, for example, Sheila Cascaden is heading up the planning for the February retreat and has identified a variety of people in the Senate who are interested and have actually been pursuing these things. They haven't done it in quite the same way, but I think everyone is interested in trying to figure out how to make our processes stronger. There's some suggestions here that are really targeted to our House ways of being, how we do set our agenda, how we decide how to structure our committees and our time frames. There's some things that are clearly in the joint rules that would have to be an agreement between both. And then there's all others that will have a major impact on the state administration. If we require, for example, there's one that says that all the governor's budget bills would be introduced the week that the governor's address comes out. You know, that changes, you know, time frames for state agencies to think through about when they get their bills drafted and introduced and that sort of thing. So it has an impact potentially on all aspects of government in terms of its time frames and how it pursues its business. And we'd hope that everyone in government would be open to looking at doing things differently and debating the merits of those as this moves forward. I think it was particularly useful to have our staff also contributing ideas because they have... Many of them have served for a long time, have seen the committee structure and the process operate under very different leadership of both parties, and, you know, they bring some wisdom and insight that those of us who look at it from the point of view of sitting at the table with a vote may not see as much as our staff do. So I think this is hopefully going to be a process that involves everyone here.
Representative Liebling, you had a... Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam, Mr. Chair. Touche. Mr. Chair and Representative Tingelstad, Representative Wachler. Two things. One, just a quick question. Is it too late to put in any more ideas? Is that process closed at this point?
Representative Liebling. Wachler.
Well, we're doing this as we go, Mr. Chairman. I think we had talked about at one point saying we'd send out the initial set of ideas for people to rank and then allow people in that process to bring in more ideas as well, because we know when you see one idea on paper that triggers something else in your mind and you bring it through, but the problem is at some point you have to... We'll never get the survey out if we keep waiting for new ideas because they do keep trickling in. And so I think at the point we're ready to launch this internet survey, we're going to kind of close the doors, not on new ideas, but on terms of the ones that will be ranked. Because I've had at least, I know, 6 or 7 people have come up to me and say, oh, yeah, I mean to get you that thing, but I just haven't had time to think it through or write it up. And so I think, you know, at some point we're going to have to send this out. I don't know that it's firmly closed at this point, but we are hoping to get the survey out maybe even in the next week.
Chair Tingelstad?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, and I think too, you know, with just our process here, how, you know, bills come together and amendments are put on, you know, certainly it's open all the way, as far as that goes. But we were just basically looking for a ranking, and so we'll, you know, do the best that we can to incorporate things quickly here soon. But once we're done with the ranking, obviously, then it's in the bill process as we normally do here.
A follow-up question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And the second thing is more in the nature of, I guess, a request or a suggestion, and that is that when you put this into this survey format, which I think is a great idea, a great way to do it, would be to either rank them or at least put in there something about the ease of implementation of various things. Some of them are constitutional amendments, and others of them are just changes in practices. So there's a huge, you know, there might be some things that could be implemented right away and others that would be a much longer term thing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, certainly we, you know, understand, you know, all the variety of things with this list here. And we're hoping that, you know, once we get information out, too, there'll be a variety of people who will work on it in different ways. Certainly, you know, obviously a constitution memo is much more involved than some internal practice here that, you know, could be done even without a rule change in the House. So, they run the gamut, that's for sure.
Any other questions from committee members? Representative Hosh.
I'll try to keep this brief and hopefully not offend anybody too. I'm really encouraged to see this happen. It's very much needed. And just to address a couple of things that Representative Peterson stated about Senate buy-in, I don't think having to have Senate buy-in or buy-in from leadership should be a top priority. I think trying to have a discussion on these, and if there's not buy-in, we know who to point the finger at. We know it's going to be the Senate's fault or the leadership's fault, and that's fine. But we need to have some accountability. And I hope that members of this committee are committed to this and put, you know, what's best for the process in front of party loyalty and in front of positioning and so on and so forth, because it happens on both sides of the aisle in both bodies. And it establishes right away a lack of trust between so many people, and I think that's what the problem is. And I hope that, you know, this isn't just lip service, but something that we can move forward on, because last year was frustrating. So it's.
I might draw attention to Representative Hosh and how much more mellow he is now. He's newly married, and you can see that it's just settled into his persona very well. Congratulations. Any other questions from the committee? Seeing none?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, thanks for allowing us to present this. And it's certainly, you know, bigger than the two of us, obviously. We're hoping that our committee members individually will get involved, and obviously this will move through a lot of different committees. Rules will be a big piece of it. But we, you know, hoping to take it to the next steps here, and appreciate any support or buy-in everybody can have. So thank you.
Well, on behalf of the committee, I'd like to thank both of you for your forward effort, bipartisan work on this process, and we're looking forward to some good reforms coming here. And seeing no further business, I would... Representative Johnson.
A housekeeping note. Johnson R., Welty, Leffler, and Dempsey will be meeting at 9:45 tomorrow in the lowest level. How about the main door of the parking ramp as a common location? Anybody else who'd like to carpool with us, show up and we'll all go together tomorrow morning, 9:45.
Mr. Chair, I think there was a few other just closing announcements here at the end of the meeting. So I hope that everyone has paid for their lunch. Talk to Scott Nesky. It's $4.50. Turn in your blue sheet. What else do we need? Take the information in your packet about the driving directions for tomorrow morning.
Social Security numbers.
Social Security numbers, right. And I dress formally. And I think that's it. And is there one other thing? And then we can close up.
Nothing else?
I want to thank Shirley for the cookies, too.
Absolutely. See, no other business. GovOps is adjourned.
Thank you.